All right, good morning, everybody. Today is February 15th. This is the Land Use and Sustainability Committee meeting. I'm joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Fernandez, Richardson, and Dominguez. Good morning to everybody, and happy Valentine's, happy belated Valentine's, and happy boat show. We've got a lot of out-of-town guests and a lot of traffic, but good traffic, good for business, great weather. So for those who are here for the boat show, hope you have a great weekend. Tom, some housekeeping items. We have item number 8 to be deferred.
Correct, to defer to the April 19th Land Use Committee.
Okay. We have a time certain of 9:30 for item number 10.
Correct.
A time certain or a request for an 11 o'clock hearing on item number 6 and 7.
Correct.
Okay. Anything else to be deferred, withdrawn, or request for hearing it earlier?
I don't have any other items.
Okay. I don't see lots of people in chambers, but I'd like to try to get people out of here if you're here for a particular item, so you can, you know, raise your hand if there's an item you want to be heard.
What Picasso Housing.
Picasso Housing, okay. And I know that's Commissioner Fernandez's. Yeah. Troy, what are you here for?
Music ordinance.
Okay.
TDR talk.
Great. That one's mine. Good. Okay. Commissioner Fernandez, would you like to tee yours up first? I know that's item number, help me out here.
10.
Okay, that's at 9:30 time certain, which it's 9:45, so we can hear it.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an item I placed on the agenda last year for us to discuss the potential conversion of how we govern and regulate noise in our city. Right now, I don't consider it to be objective. It's all determined on whether a code enforcement officer can hear the noise at a certain distance when they show up, and perhaps if one code enforcement officer shows up, they hear something, and another code enforcement officer shows up, and they don't hear it. Our residents don't feel well served by this, and I suspect our business community doesn't feel well served by this either. And so last year, the city was going out to procurement for a noise consultant. When that was happening, we amended the solicitation so that this consultant could help us with possible policy to transition into a decibel-based system of enforcement, something that sets an objective criteria for regulating noise in our city so that there couldn't be any ambiguity in it. And so our city staff, our planning director, together with the city attorney's office, has worked closely with this consultant to provide acoustic consulting services as it relates to a noise pilot program with the intent of assessing the current sound levels within the city, and to evaluate the feasibility of potentially creating a quantitative decibel-based noise ordinance. And if you allow me, Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to pass it over to our planning director to guide us a little bit along this process.
Sure. And also, our consultants, Arpeggio, should be on Zoom. And PJ, if a person named Jesse Arpeggio has raised their hand, I'm not sure if it's possible to make them a panelist or not, but they're also available to answer any technical questions. But as Commissioner Fernandez correctly pointed out, at the direction of the Land Use Committee, the last time this was discussed by the committee, which was in September, we were directed to consult with our sound consultant and develop a framework for a potential pilot program. And the pilot program that was developed in coordination with our consultant basically proposes to establish a approximately 2 blocks to the north and south area that runs from Washington Avenue to Collins Avenue, from approximately 8th Street to 10th Street, and would also include the west side of Washington Avenue. And the purpose of this pilot would be to install sound meters and sound gathering devices throughout this pilot area that would measure sound over the course of 4 days. The days that have been proposed are Thursday through Sunday, which tend to be the highest intensity. And these sound meters would take into account things like weather, things like background noise, and it would basically establish a baseline. And the purpose of it would be to inform a potential decibel-based noise standard, as opposed to the current unreasonably loud and excessive noise standard that is currently used. Within this proposal put together by Arpeggio, there is also an option for in-property participation on a voluntary basis, where sound meters would be installed within properties if the property owner was willing to participate, and it would also measure the sound from within those establishments. The cost of the program is approximately $100,000, which is not budgeted. So if this is something that the committee wanted to recommend, we would need to bring this back to the full commission for authorization, either as part of the 2024 budget process, or we would need to find additional funding. The opt-in for private establishments would also cost a little bit more. Jesse or Ken, I'm not sure if there's anything that you wanted to add that I may have missed in the presentation, or any other technical information that you think might be germane to the discussion.
PJ, you want to bring them in?
Yeah, I'm in. This is Jesse. No, I think that you have summarized the outline of the scope pretty fairly, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of you might have.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please. Yeah.
And just for purposes of my edification, so the pilot area, it's from 8th Street to 10th Street, west of Collins, and it includes the west side of Washington Avenue. Is there any reason why it doesn't go all the way out to Ocean Drive, or were other areas of the city also considered for this pilot program?
In discussing the boundaries with our sound consultant, we wanted to do a limited area for two reasons. One, so that the cost didn't get out of control, but also we wanted to make sure that it was a very defined area for purposes of measuring sound. We didn't send it all the way over to Ocean because of the fact that we were looking to measure sound that might be coming from Ocean Drive. Certainly, this is a draft proposal for a pilot, and to the extent that the committee wanted to recommend either different boundaries or expanded boundaries, we could certainly do that. If it's expanded boundaries, it probably would increase the cost, and our consultant could come back with us with a revised estimate based upon that. But this particular area of South Beach tended to be one of the more intense areas in terms of sound and noise, and so that's why we had originally identified this area as being appropriate for a pilot.
And I believe that part of what drove that is that this is the area that is leaning more towards the residential, where there might be complaints lodged.
Correct. The proximity to a residential area was also factored into it. Because even though the study area itself is commercial, it's immediately abutting a residential area. And having this these base sound levels is something that would help inform a future decibel-based system because of its proximity to permanent residential areas, non-transient residential areas.
I have some questions. Thank you, Chair. So why is this Thursday through Sunday? Because I assume this is going to be equipment that's going to be installed, and couldn't it detect music or sound 7 days a week, or is it the monitoring that's only going to be done, or is there equipment installation that's involved?
Yes, there's actually quite a bit of equipment that would have to be installed both, and most of it would be within public property on things like light poles and other areas where the sound measuring equipment could not be tampered with. We could certainly do it over a longer period. We had determined that for cost reasons, in order to limit it and try to contain the cost of the pilot, that the most intense days tended to be Thursday through Sunday in terms of noise being generated. But we could certainly do it over the course of a week.
So the equipment would be installed. So what's the cost? Is what, someone to monitor the measurement or something?
Correct. And Jesse, you can fill in the blanks, but I believe that the intent of having it up for 4 days is that the consultant's team would need to first go in and install all of the equipment, calibrate it, and then they would start the measuring from Thursday through Sunday. Obviously, they want to be as discreet as possible because they don't want people to all of a sudden just be quiet for 4 days and skew the results. But I believe that they need about a week to install all of the equipment before they do the measuring. Jesse, anything I missed on that?
Well, so there would be two trips involved in this. One would be a kind of a scoping logistics trip just to identify where this equipment can be installed. And again, this equipment is only going to be installed for 4 days per the proposal. And the point of it is to establish baseline sound level. So back to the description of the scope, make one visit to identify where we're going to put these so that when we come back to install them, we know where we're going and all the logistics are worked out and we have the required buy-in and assistance from the city in terms of any equipment we may need, like lifts or things like that. Installation of the equipment, should take a number of hours, possibly a day or up to a day. And then we would be on site through the duration of the survey.
So let me just see if I understand. So the pilot is only a 4 day pilot.
Correct.
So you're going to install all this equipment, then you're going to listen for 4 days, and that's the end of the pilot.
Correct. As proposed.
It seems like that's a lot of work to put all that equipment in, and then 4 days may not give us enough data, quite frankly. So. I'm not wildly supportive. So first of all, let me say I am very supportive of this approach, because 2 years ago I said we need to get something more objective than just having a pair of ears and then somebody else shows up and they have a different pair of ears and it seems a little unfair at times. So I very much like the idea. We all know that one of our biggest issues is on Ocean Drive, so I think the sound typically goes to the ocean, but I don't know why that wouldn't be included, because that's where I think our bigger issue is. I get that on Washington it abuts a residential across the street, but I would be more supportive of at least including Ocean Drive and including more than just a 4 day period. If we're going to install the equipment, it seems to me that we should, because that's got to be a big piece of the cost, is the installation, and then we should monitor it for a longer period of time. That's kind of my feeling.
Hey, Mr. Chair?
Just to follow up on some of the points that Commissioner Richardson mentioned, I just want to ask the representative from the company, because in addition, I just want confirmed for the record, in addition to installing equipment, it's not just the installation of equipment, but it's also having representatives on the ground in the field roaming the area to identify and to manually log any prominent noise factors that perhaps may not be logged or may not be captured by the technology, but that their representatives on the ground level could capture, or maybe noise that may not be generated from an establishment but from other sources. And so I just want to confirm that that's part of what is being proposed, these individuals on the ground within the study area.
You're absolutely correct. Installation of the stationary equipment is a portion of the cost, but another portion is having personnel on site during the duration of the survey to roam around and just to oversee the survey. And then at the end of whatever period of time it is, then we would take down the equipment, ship it back, and all that. The scope also includes modeling, but we haven't computer modeling using our measurement results, but we haven't gotten to that point yet.
So I would just like to suggest, colleagues, and I would love to hear from Commissioner Dominguez and the chair, but perhaps this is not a pilot program. This is a study period. You know, once we get facts and data as to possible decibel levels and all that, that perhaps that's when we actually have a pilot program. But this right now, really what it is, it's not a pilot program because we're not testing decibels right now. What we're doing is we're fact gathering to determine whether a decibel system is even feasible here. So this is more like a study. I wouldn't call this necessarily our pilot program, but just putting that out there, because if we see it from the lens of it being a pilot program, it's truly not a pilot program, but it's a fact-finding study period. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that the whole purpose for this noise survey is to establish and quantify what sound levels are in this particular geographic area, and then the modeling will help, the measurements will help us to produce a heat map, basically a color-coded map showing what sound levels are as a function of day and so forth. So it would inform any subsequent initiatives by telling us inclusively, you know, how loud is, you know, on these specific days and specific times.
So when I had the meeting with the city administration, in my notes I put that the city wasn't in favor of doing a pilot, but this approach of studying to see if we should or should not do a pilot seems like it makes more sense. Does the city feel comfortable with that?
As indicated in the memo, we did express some concerns with converting to a decibel-based system. We also had some concerns with the cost involved in the study. Obviously, that's a policy decision. Clearly, if there is a will to spend the money that is required, it would have to either be part of the 2024 budget process, or those funds would need to be identified if there's a desire to move forward this year.
Thanks.
And if I could just add a little bit to that, you know, the administration's concern is not about the study, or obviously we want to control the noise within our city so that it's not bothersome to the residential community. Our challenge is that we're concerned, based on prior history, whether or not the use of a specific decibel level as opposed to the unreasonable and excessive criteria is going to be upheld in court. And we don't want to violate people just to have those violations thrown out at a later date.
And there's, if I can chime in on that, I mean, that is a very valid concern, because after this fact-finding, data collecting portion of the scope, the 4-day or 7-day or however long survey, where we have established what sound levels are in the area, then, you know, when you get down to the point of, say, enforcing a decibel-based system, it's still incumbent on whoever's doing the enforcement, the officials on the ground, to make the argument that, well, the sound level, you know, at the sidewalk at this place or across the street is in excess of the decibel limit, but then it's incumbent on them to conclusively say, and it's because of venue X or venue Y. And I mean, that is certainly one of the bigger challenges broadly in this. You know, there are a lot of noise sources, so that is my two cents added on to that, the challenge of the decibel basis.
Yeah, what you just said was one of my concerns. This won't distinguish music coming from a restaurant or a bar necessarily versus traffic. So somebody with a Harley Davidson, for example, which are very loud, motorcycles or, you know, a converted automobile that's souped up to make noise, that'll register on the decibel meter, and we won't be able to know whether that was coming from a nightclub or coming from traffic?
That is true. All this equipment is just logging data. It's not collecting audio.
Yeah, so, I mean, my sentiment is I'm very supportive of it because of an objective measure. We can get some baseline. We can, you know, have data to support or refute, you know, comments that are coming from certain neighborhoods. It gives us a baseline. My concern will be, among other concerns, will be what he just said, which is we won't be able to distinguish where the noise came from. The other concern I have is just the timeline. You know, these are short pilots. I may have missed it, but what's the incremental cost if we said we want to run this for a month? What does that do to the cost?
Jesse, would you need to get back to us with some revised cost estimates if there was a desire to expand the length of the analysis, say, to 7 days or even beyond?
Yeah, I'll definitely have to get back to you. I mean, a big part of the cost would be how long would we be on site? Because that's man hours. That's a huge piece of the cost. I mean, we could easily deploy the equipment, leave it on site for a month, whatever, and just let it run without our presence. But the original thought was that we would deploy the equipment, do the 4-day survey, during which time we would be physically on site. We'll also perform roaming sound level measurements.
Colleagues, how would you feel about something like that? Where, what's the value, Jesse, of having someone on site versus just letting it run and then we come back and analyze the data? You know, I didn't know that the cost was attributable to man hours. So if we take out the man hours and we just install the equipment and let it run for a month, colleagues, do you care if there's a man hours involved, or can we just let the meters run and then we analyze the data?
And Mr. Chair, perhaps some sort of hybrid could be a good path forward in this, because I do see the value in having some manpower to identify and manually log prominent sources of noise. And to your concern, because you raised actually a very good concern on noise coming from cars, and it's a big problem that we have in this city. And it was one of the things that I liked about the proposal that the planning department brought us, is that all this equipment will be time synchronized so that they can establish correlations in the data that they're receiving in terms of noise. So, for example, if you had a loud car that's going through the area and it's affecting the decibel system on 8th Street, well, you may be able to identify as it progresses through the study area. But to your question, perhaps we could do some sort of hybrid, keep the technology here for a month, and maybe over you know, 2 4-day periods instead of one 4-day period, the staff could be in the area to help identify some of these other sources of noise.
Yes. So, Tom or Eric, what does the county do? Because the county has, this is the way they do it. They have a decibel level. And how do they do it? So that and maybe code, I see is here. Maybe, I don't know if code has decibel level meters they take out. I'm just looking on my phone. You can buy one as cheap as $20, and I see one for $600 or $700. Do we carry these with us? Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner. Tom Curator, Assistant Director of Code Compliance. We use them on occasion just for certain venues, just to was pilot to use them. But the whole thing with the meters, as Commissioner Ariola mentioned, the human ear can differentiate sound. So if you're yelling or you're yelling, I know where it's coming from. If I point the meter, you still need the person there to see where it's coming from. And also you have the environmental noise and noise passing. And also meters have to be calibrated. So a lot of the meters on the phone may not be calibrated. Because when you go to court, they're going to say, like you do for when they're speeding, they calibrated meters. So there's all different, you know, aspects. And I think the county is, maybe the city attorney is also know. I think the county is 90 decibel levels, which is pretty high. So I think that I know during COVID, the county was 90, and we were actually lower than that for ambient. So it's all.
So what about the combination of the subjective with your two ears and the objective with a meter? Like, if you're there and you think you have a problem based on your ears, which is subjective, can you pull out the noise level meter and test it and then see if it's exceeding? I get that there's other noises going around, but your ears are hearing other noises going around as well, right? Yep. I'm just wondering if we could have that as a secondary and pilot that, if you will. If you go out on a call about noise, if you could have your subjective and your objective. Is that something we could try?
Whatever the body wants, we could try anything.
Yeah. So, because I don't think this four-day, as you said, it's not really a pilot, it's more like a study. I would be more in favor of putting the equipment up and just letting it run for a month and see what it gets in combination with the work that you all are doing on the street.
And just so you know, also historically, and it's still a fact, that most of our noise comes from residential. Most of our noise.
Residential
properties, people calling, you know, for noise. Like parties maybe in more the North End and stuff like that. Most of our noise complaints historically, and still to this day, it's more residential than commercial on noise complaints.
Interesting. Like,
it could be loud music from houses. It could be construction noise.
Okay. So if you had to guess, and maybe you don't need to guess, you might have statistics, but like if you had 100 complaints for noise, would 80% of them come from private homes?
Well, in our last, actually, out of the 451 complaints we had, 273 came residential, which is about 60.53%, and 117 from commercial, and then 61 from other sources, whether it's a barking dog or, you know, something like that, loud music, you know, from construction. And that's historically. It's mostly residential.
And are they coming from all over the city, or are there pockets of, if because you know the location, are there pockets?
Well, actually, we did, by district last year, 2,886 noise complaints, 700 middle, 540 in the north, and about 1,646 in the south. So,
yeah.
So, you know, it's a balance, but that's what most historically into this day is mostly residential.
And what about having on the commercial, where you have commercial complaints, what about approaching them and asking them if they would like to do a pilot in their business establishment? Because that may get us closer to where we want to be.
That's up to, I guess, would that be any?
Well, I think the administration's memo does reference that part of the pilot program would be asking business owners to opt in to installing sound monitoring equipment on the inside, so that we could, as part of our study, help determine what is an appropriate level. Tom, is there anything you would add to that?
Yeah, it would have to be on a voluntary basis.
Right.
We couldn't impose that on an existing establishment. If they were willing to participate, then we could potentially do that. There is actually an option in the proposal for that. The thing that we do have to be careful about is that those sound meters would need to be installed in a way that they would be fully tamper-proof.
And if you yield, because I see this, so this determines a baseline decibel for an area, but it does not determine what the decibel is for individual establishments. And when we look at their proposal, you know, they make it clear here they're not telling us what individual decibels should be for individual establishments. And in fact, I understand that even through a CUP process or some other process, you know, based on the data that we get in the consultation of this company, we could determine what an individual decibel should be per establishment, depending on the built environment, whether they have vestibules and that type of stuff. Because ultimately, you know, this, how I see this really functioning is, you know, a decibel system that is governed by a house sound system, that usually these are tamper-proof or is usually what we require is for these establishments to have tamper-proof sound systems. And so if you set a decibel level by which that establishment needs to govern itself by, you can easily regulate it and make sure that establishment is keeping true to that level through their house sound system. And that would eventually be further down the process. But correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, if that's usually how it works.
That's correct. And I think that's the intent of this proposal, is to move in that direction.
Okay.
All right, colleagues, where do you want to go with this?
Let me ask another question about these meters. What's involved in calibrating a meter?
That I don't know. That would have to be.
Jesse might be able to.
Yeah, maybe Jesse could.
To answer that. Jesse, can you explain briefly what's involved in that?
Yeah, basically you have what's called a calibrator. It's often a little box or a little cylinder which emits a very specific tone at a very specific level, level being volume, and you just fix it. You just place it over the microphone. You put it snug in there, so where it's seated in the calibrator, and you see what the meter is registering, and you change what it's registering based on the known sound level produced by the calibrator. So it's a very quick and simple thing. Cheaper meters might be a little bit different, where you have to have like a set screw to adjust it, but more professional meters are you calibrate it electronically, but it always involves a calibrator that emits a known tone at a known volume.
So I'm not, I don't think this is really quite ready for where I can support what's being proposed right now, because I think the 4 days is not enough. I think that maybe we should look at how the county, I don't know how the county's doing, if they're going out with meters or so forth, but maybe a combination of the handheld and the subjective from the compliance officer. I'm not opposed to doing this, a study like this, but having heard that a lot of the noise complaints are coming from homes, this is really not going to get us any closer to that, because these complaints are random, right? Because you've got a party here and a party there and so forth. So,
but if you yield on that point, I mean, I just heard from our planning director, the reason why we're going to Washington Avenue is because we're getting complaints from the residential that's close to commercial on the noise. So the fact that we're getting complaints from residential doesn't mean that it's all originating from residential. We may be getting complaints from residents, but it could be originating from commercial too.
Yeah, this pilot was predicated upon establishing the baseline so that we could determine what the baseline is in proximity to areas that are abutting a residential district, because that's typically where we get complaints about these commercial uses, and that's what our focus was with regard to this pilot. I think what Tom Curatori is talking about is that they receive complaints all over the city, single-family districts, multifamily districts, neighbors complaining about neighbors having a loud party or just playing their stereo too loud. This is something a little bit different, because this focuses on commercial establishments and the noise being generated by those commercial establishments.
So, but I think if I heard right, only about 40% of the total complaints are coming from commercial businesses. And then I don't know how many complaints are coming from 8th to 10th Street in this. Do we know, have we looked to see if there are any complaints from residents about commercial noise between 8th and 10th Street? I don't know.
There's a few. I could break the number, not now, but I can get you the numbers. Also, the establishment types, out of the 451, 110 cases apartment, 9 from bars, 16 from clubs, 79 from condos, 18 from condo hotels, 84 from homes. Then we have restaurant, 53. So it's a lot of different. We're getting the complaints. And, we can't even take anonymous complaints anymore with Senate Bill 60. Those people have to give their name. Also, so it's not like people calling on a different building or a different establishment and not giving a name.
Right. How much work was involved in telling us how many complaints were made between 8th and 10th Street in the year that you're looking at? on Washington Avenue, because that's really the area we're talking about.
Yeah,
if there's one complaint, then I'm not sure this is a good area, you know? But is that something?
Yes, that's doable. I'll get you that information.
Would you mind if we looked at that? And
of course.
Back
and perhaps if it's the desire of this body, what could also happen is that the company could come back next month with an updated proposal on what a one-month long, as Commissioner Arreola suggested, a one-month long study period would entail, and maybe instead of just having their staff here for 1 4-day study period, maybe we could do 2 4-day study periods. So you have the equipment out there for 30 days, and they come in two different locations to have that on-the-ground presence and documentation of any, you know, out of the ordinary noise sources.
And the rest of the time, we would just monitor without people on the street. Right. I would also like to see that proposal.
Yeah. Eric, through the chair, just one quick question. There have been several different parallel conversations going on as far as the day-to-day monitoring and violation issuance from code compliance, and then there's a very different but very interesting conversation about the CUP process that we're talking about here for potentially regulating commercial businesses that might be frequent flyers on this issue. I'm just wondering what's the will of the body to, because we can tailor it different ways, or do you want it to be all-encompassing?
If I may. Right now we're not looking at a policy. We're not creating legislation. The proposal that your department, that your staff has brought forward, description's not included in the proposal, drafting a proposed or revised noise ordinance. We're not doing that right now. What we're doing right now is that we're studying our environment to establish this baseline to see if it's even feasible to have a decibel system in this area. I think we need to, that's the starting point. I think before we talk about enforcement and day-to-day and what type of decibel readers are going to be used, we just need the pure, raw, basic data here. I think we're getting ahead of ourselves in this conversation.
We're not writing a policy yet. We're studying. So I would like to do what we said, bring back next month, and in addition to that, do some more research for us and tell us what the county's doing, how they manage it. Do they carry equipment out with them? How much is that equipment? Like I said, I'm looking. I think you can buy something anywhere from $20 to $600 or $700, yep, maybe more. What's the best equipment? If we were to say we want all officers to carry equipment and, you know, have both your subjective and your objective, that may be part of a pilot program as well. And then the other thing is I'd like you to do some analysis on where the largest concentration of noise complaints is coming from, commercial, where, you know, non-commercial people are complaining about commercial businesses, since that seems to be the focus of this.
And just the last thing on the left, put my 2 cents in here too. On the last quarter, we had more complaints from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Out of the 451, we had 309 from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., and from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., we had 142. So just...
But for next month, come back and tell us if there are concentrations in the city, again, as Mr. Carpenter said, of noise coming from commercial that abuts residential.
Okay.
Maybe we'll get closer to landing on what we want to do with a study. And then you can get the potential vendor to update to tell us what it would cost for a month. And having, as Commissioner Fernandez said, 2 4-day periods where people are on the street, the rest of the time is just being monitored without people on the street.
Yeah. All right. Let me say a few words. I'm supportive of, you know, getting some baseline objective measures. You know, let it run for like a month. I'd like to do it at a cost-friendly basis. $100,000 for 4 days is, I'm not comfortable with that. But, you know, I'd also be interested in, you know, maybe doing a control group. You know, pick a quiet neighborhood, you know, somewhere, just to say, okay, baseline a quiet neighborhood, decibel levels are X. noisy neighborhood, the MXC, it's Y. Just to understand that, and if we can look at over a period of a month, day parts, you know, sometimes during the day or at night it's louder or quieter, and then days of the week, you know, just to have that data, right, so that we can share that with neighbors. And I think you raised some really interesting points about, you know, where these complaints are coming from. Very often it's from your neighbor who's having a party or something that's, you know, interfering with your quiet enjoyment. It's not a business that's driving the complaints. The other thing in my experience, too, is what starts annoying people, it's not so much the noise from the establishment. It's the patrons when they leave a restaurant or a club or the waiting line to get in. They're the ones making the noise. Most responsible businesses are very good about keeping the noise indoors and having noise mitigation through their own efforts to contain the noise inside. It's usually the patrons that are creating the problem. So, you know, when we start hearing complaints about a business, that business may do a very good job of containing the noise. It's the patrons, you know. And so we're not going to be able to use a decibel meter against that business if they're not creating the noise, right?
But what happens, Commissioner, is that a stakeholder in the community, whether it be a competitor or a resident or a visitor, calls and complains about the business.
Yep, that happens.
And now the business is stuck with a violation.
Yep.
On something that may not pertain to them, on something that's completely subjective, and now they're stuck in a special master process, yep, having to hire someone when an objective system that says, okay, your decibel level is, I don't know, 70, 75, or whatever it may be. And if we have a system like that, that's tied to their house sound system, that is recording that information, that when code gets there, that they can see, okay, what is the number that's actually playing right now in the decibels? Now, that's an objective factor that they can use, that if they get still cited, that they can come in to Special Master and show, listen, here's my decibel reading from my sound system, and this is the exact decibel that was playing in my house system at 11:36 at night, you know? And so that's the difference with this. But thank you for your consideration of this item, and to the planning department for working very hard on this. It'd be great to see the information that Commissioner Richardson requested from code enforcement, and as well the company coming back with what a longer study period would look like.
Mr. Chairman, I have one caller now on Zoom.
Okay.
Zalman Felig.
Okay. Good morning. Zalman, you're on.
Okay. How do I put like to put my camera on? Hold on 1 second.
If you want, we can hear you.
I think it works. No, I'd like to put the camera on. How do you put the camera on?
Okay.
It doesn't work.
We may have disabled that feature, Zalman.
That's right.
Oh, I would like you to see my glowing face.
We can picture it. We can hear the smile coming through Zoom.
I hope so. Actually, I'm going to put a picture next time so you can actually see it. First of all, first and foremost, as the foundation of a human being, I just want to say thank you to everyone that's there giving their time to make Miami Beach a better place and improvements. And I'm grateful. And I try to wake up in the morning and say that I'm grateful for everything. So I want to say I'm grateful for your service that you do for Miami Beach. I know it's not the most glorified position, but I just want to thank you for that. I know a lot of you for many, many years. I know Tom Mooney over 25 years and et cetera. I agree with Commissioner Richardson that it's interesting because I also believe that you can't just use this decimal thing to go ahead and evaluate and take the information from that. You know, a police officer, when he's called to a scene, he should use sometimes his discretion what to do. Obviously, there's policies in place, but you have to also use your human discretion how to handle a situation. It's the same thing here. That I think in general that code enforcement does a overall nice and good job. It's not an easy job, but they do their job, and you need a combination of some type of mechanism that they can see what the sound level is, if it's a handheld, and obviously they're them being there physically to see if it's not a Harley Davidson, like the other, like Commissioner Ricky brought up, etc. And I mean, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of information that has to be brought together. And the gentleman from code enforcement brought up that it's interesting that the least complaints come from the south, and a lot of 60 something percent come from residential. So it's not from the businesses. And obviously we have to get all information together and come up with a, you know, all you have to come up with together with a good solution to have this in place and see what like Miami City and other places are doing. That's important. So we don't maybe don't have to even reinvent the wheel. But my position in general is about seeing how to support the businesses, because there are other players. I know now is not the time to speak about it. I'm just going to bring it up short. There are other major players in town. I'm living here 40 years. I'm in Sunset Harbor close to 39 years. Part of the beautiful growth in Sunset Harbor. And unfortunately, I see a lot of people going to other places. Like there's other players, Wynwood, Coconut Grove. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And I'm not going to do that now. But we have to also figure out how to support. I know it's not the platform now for this, but to support the businesses as many are going out of business, and to be a little more supportive. As you all know, I'm not going to bring it up now again with the permitting, people who open up, you know, right, stores in Fort Lauderdale.
We're running out of time. Sorry.
I'm sorry. So okay. I just want to just bring out that we need more information to figure out how to do this so there is not a not good end result, and we don't monitor it and put people out of businesses or et cetera.
All right, Zellman, we're out of time. Thank you for your time this morning.
Hi, yes, thank you. Daniel Serrato with Miami Design Preservation League. I just wanted to mention, too, about sensors and technology. I wonder if there are any ways to measure the noise, you know, more inexpensively. One thing recently with our cell phones, we have ways to check lights, turn lights on, check the temperature, you know. So one thought I just had in hearing you all talk is I wonder, could we put some sensors in Lummis Park, you know, in the trees, and just have some sort of measure of the sound that would be an ongoing thing? Because we don't get a lot of residents in the Art Deco district at night in the busy areas, so there might not be a lot of phone calls, or it might be visitors, but a lot of you have been there at night. Sometimes those restaurants are way too loud. So how can we be proactive, and hopefully you could help find the solution? Thank you.
Troy?
Hi. Really quick, you know, with the sound, obviously everything is variable, but my concern is when you set this up, if you set it up between 8 and 10, we have a hotel that is not open right now, that is closed and probably will be open in 2 months. That's 181 units. In addition to that, there's another hotel that on the corner of that's another 42 units that is not open right now. And so I think if a measurement were to be taken now, it would be inaccurate because it will be different. The sound level will be different 3 or 4 months from now. So that is something that we have to consider when we take this sample, the amount of traffic in those areas. Thanks.
Okay.
So we'll show this continue to the April 19th meeting and to come back with that additional information, including the updated sound study costs.
Yeah, that item took longer than I expected. So I'm looking at just trying to condense our agenda because we have to leave by 12:30. Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez has two items, 12 and 17. Unless she's able to join, we'll defer those. And then are you leaving, Commissioner Brennan?
I'm gonna going up to...
You're coming back?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll wait for your other item then.
Okay, cool. Okay. Thank you.
All right, so then...
Excuse me. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but this is Jesse with Arpeggio. If you wanted to, so we're kind of in a holding pattern on our end. If you want a revised quote, then we will need the parameters for the proposed scope.
Staff will be in touch with you separately, Jesse, and then we'll work that out.
Okay, great, sorry.
Great,
okay. Thank you for participating, Jesse.
You're welcome.
Then when Commissioner Fernandez returns, we'll take up item number 5. In the meantime, let's take up item number 11, which was my item, discuss permitting live entertainment to promote arts and culture. I'll just sort of tee this up and just with sort of a disclaimer, because I think we've all gotten emails. Don't know why people do this, but they sort of just immediately jump to the worst and assume the worst and don't bother reading the intent of this. And despite I've been talking about this for well over 2 years, probably my entire tenure, to try to do something that is very good for residents, very good for our visitors, and very good for our businesses. I think most of us who enjoy traveling or going out to, you know, enjoy life, enjoy entertainment, whether it's a Broadway show, a comic show, poetry readings, or even live music, heaven forbid. We all enjoy it. We go literally out of town to go do these things. And, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult in Miami Beach to find venues and areas that even permit any live entertainment. And I've maintained, you know, and talked to many lawyers about this, our current live entertainment definition is overbroad. I've said this many times. Our current definition of live entertainment would prohibit pantomime, which doesn't make any noise whatsoever. That would be something that would be prohibited. Another classic example is, you know, plugging in my iPhone and playing music at a certain decibel threshold would be allowed. A DJ coming in playing the exact same music at the exact same decibel level would not be allowed. So, you know, there's a lot of issues I have with our current live entertainment definition. The definition, I think, needs to be more carefully thought through. And then the other thing is, you know, do we want to have avenues for businesses to avail themselves of permits, whether the conditional use permits, special event permits, you know, and other reasonable restrictions on hours, days of the week, to allow live entertainment, things that are not intrusive to surrounding neighbors, that aren't promoting, you know, a wild party atmosphere, but are conducive to a dining experience or, experiences that patrons like. To the point that Zelman was making earlier, you know, we are more than ever in a competition with surrounding cities and neighborhoods. You know, Wynwood, Design District, Midtown, Brickell, Coconut Grove, even Coral Gables, more than ever now have destinations for tourists and locals. And even our own locals here in Miami Beach are now going to those venues because they can't find these amenities locally. In areas where we allow live entertainment, such as the MXC, residents don't go there for lots of reasons. They're not going there. We are more and more positioning ourselves to hold ourselves out as an arts and culture destination. Voters overwhelmingly supported a significant investment in our cultural institutions. So I'm bringing this forward to see if we can create something responsible that would be an amenity for residents, an amenity for visitors, and help support local businesses. And, you know, under the auspices of promoting arts and culture, if a venue wants to do something that would support arts and culture, give them a path to do that. And I'm open to suggestions, whether it's conditional use permits, special events permits, restrictions on hours of operation, days of the week. I do think this is something we should explore rather than just have a blanket prohibition almost citywide.
So I previously have said that I am supportive of a pilot program, one that would be very limited, maybe 6 months or a year, that would sunset unless it's continued. But I very much believe that we should allow establishments to offer some sort of live entertainment on a very limited basis. You know, I previously mentioned maybe from very limited hours on Saturday and Sunday in a pilot program until you know, on Sunday until 6 or 7 o'clock at night, maybe no starting no earlier than 11 a.m., and then on Saturday. So that's the kind of thing I think would be really good for us to pilot. Very limited, 6 months to a year, so we study it and see if we want to continue it. Because I think if we do something like that, the people are going to see that it's not going to be a disruption to their way of life. And we can be able to have a jazz combo for a Sunday brunch and have people enjoy that. We can also limit it to indoors. And so if we don't want to have outdoor, that sort of thing, or have outdoor if no one's within 200 feet or something like that. So I don't know if staff has thought about how we might craft some sort of pilot program, but I would be very supportive of something like that.
Yeah, and I'm all for piloting, get people comfortable, get us to adjust where we overdo it or underdo it. And look, if anything's abused, they lose the right. You know, this is a short-term pilot, and we can put whatever conditions, if there's an appetite for this, whatever conditions we deem appropriate to address the concerns of those who think that this is going to open Pandora's box, which I don't think it will. We can have parameters that allow us to sample something that would support local businesses and be an amenity for residents and for tourists. I mean, look, there's so many examples where you just see the restriction is just overbroad, and I think our definition is illegal. Nick, correct me if I'm wrong. If I wanted to rent out my neighborhood pizza joint for during the day and have a birthday party for my son and bring in a magician or a clown show, would that be permissible?
Under our code, a magician or a clown show would be entertainment. So in a district where entertainment is prohibited, you couldn't have it.
Right. So this is why I have problems with it. Because, you know, I understand the concerns of residents who's like, oh my God, you know, you're going to open up to rock and roll live entertainment. No, that's not what I'm trying to do. But I am trying to create an environment where residents can enjoy businesses, whether it's a jazz brunch or rent out a venue. Because most people here live in apartments. Very hard to have a party in an apartment. And if you wanted to bring in live entertainment, you got to hope the code's looking the other way. Otherwise, they can get shut down. And for a parent that wants to have, you know, a magician come in with a bunch of kids, if code comes in and shuts it down, that is traumatic for the children and really embarrassing for the family that's trying to do something. So what happens is you have to go across the bay and find a venue that will accommodate you. So.
I've received a lot of feedback from South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor, and they don't want to entertain anything like that. So I think that if you're looking for entertainment that doesn't make noise, like a magician, a pantomime, community outreach is the first thing that we need to do for both of those neighborhoods. Other neighborhoods that are more supportive, like Collins Park or the Entertainment District, I think a pilot program and looking to changes makes sense to me. But for South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor, no, unless there's extensive community outreach.
Are there folks on the line?
Yeah, yes, there are. Our first caller is Zalman Fellig.
Okay. Zalman, yeah. Good morning.
Yes,
2 minutes.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, the woman who spoke last, your name is?
That was Commissioner Laura Dominguez.
Ah, okay, Laura, how are you? I think I last saw you, I think, was outside of City Miami Beach. I just want to mention that it's really not fair to, you know, just hear what Sunset Harbor, for example, Sunset Harbor. I've been here 40 years. I've seen this place really grow beautifully, organically, and a lot of locals. It doesn't make sense to me. Like, one of my tenants is Moloco. They have a restaurant right across Office Depot near the car wash. And they have a beautiful establishment. They have literally a botanical gardens, and they cannot have a DJ indoors. It doesn't make sense. And what we're doing is we're creating businesses that are closing. And I know that Sunset Harbor, there are people sitting in the towers that I was here when Mr. Betza you know, was fighting for the air rights, they would like to see a park in front of them. But the bottom line is there are businesses here that have been here for who knows how many years, establishments, and we can't just tell them you can't have a DJ indoors. We're not talking about outside, indoors. And I'm sure, let's say, for example, Moloko, if you told him, you know what, put in some type of monitor that we can have inside your place to monitor it, if he, of course, would agree to it, he would. All he wants is to have a DJ. And like Commissioner Aurelio said, that, I mean, if someone wants to make a birthday party, they are going to other places. I'm in touch with Mid Beach. I'm in touch with over 400 tenants and many people in the city of Miami Beach. It doesn't make sense to have a blanket and it's illegal. And all what you're creating is the same thing when it comes to permits. It's so hard to get a freaking permit in Miami Beach that you know what people do? They don't pull permits, as we all know. So the point is you've got to find a middle ground that's fair. A restaurant like Moloko that's high end, for example, beautiful people, the locals love to come there, including the people from Sunset Harbor and the associations, and they love it. Not to have a DJ indoors, it doesn't make sense to me.
Your 2 minutes are up.
Okay. Commissioner Dominguez.
I've been to Moloko. It's an absolutely beautiful place. I think that community outreach would be the first and most important thing. It's not what happens indoors, it's what happens outdoors. And Sunset Harbor really fought Purdy Lounge for almost 20 years, and it wasn't what was happening indoors. It was the noise, the fights, the loud carrying on that affected their neighborhood.
Yeah, and I'll talk about Purdy. I mean, I think that's an example. It became incompatible with the neighborhood. You know, that was a 5 a.m. bar, which, you know, I think there's already a lot of protections to prevent that from ever happening again. There is already a prohibition. You can't have a 5 a.m. license. But I think when we're talking about restaurants or other types of businesses, I think we can perhaps find middle ground here. Troy.
Hi, Troy Wright, Washington Avenue Bid. I think we're at a point where we desperately need music on Miami Beach. It's at a point where on Friday night, for example, and I'll be fast, I wanted live music. And I said, well, I could go to Washington Avenue, but there's only one place that has live music on Washington Avenue. And I surveyed to find out that really, I think there was only one place in general where you can find live music on a Friday night. This is Miami Beach. That is a sad statement to make. See, a couple of years ago, Washington Avenue did a program where we had live music the third Thursday of each night at 12 different locations. We started out, we received about 500 guests. It grew to almost 900 guests. We never had one violation, never had one issue, never had one problem. But there was a desire and a need for people to want to hear live music, and not just necessarily on Washington Avenue, but in other places. There were a couple of places that wanted to have live music but couldn't have live music because of the current ordinances. So I think that there has to be a way that we fix this problem, and I think I support 100% what you're saying, Commissioner Areola, that we have to find a way to have live music and to continue to attract people. Otherwise, there is no reason to come to Miami Beach for entertainment. So I fully support what you are offering here.
Yeah, I went to the restaurant The Queen, which opened, I think most of us maybe checked it out, opened last week on Saturday night. And, you know, going down Washington Avenue at night, it was shocking, very sad and troubling to see how many vacancies there are on Washington Avenue. I mean, almost every block had a vacancy. Some blocks had, for continuous blocks, multiple vacancies, which is bad for a city, right? It brings blight, it brings crime, it decreases safety, we desperately need to fix the MXE district. Kudos to the investment that was made at the Paris Theater, significant investment, and I hope that helps revitalize Washington Avenue. But you know, I think, you know, overzealous zoning over the years compounds. You know, we've killed Lincoln Road, and you know, Washington Avenue right now is still trying to rebound. And you know, more and more of that will happen the more restrictive we become, and the less willing we're trying to be imaginative in approaches. Are there more callers?
Yes, our next caller is Laura.
Laura, you're on.
Oh, hello.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So we're at the restaurant Molo Concert at Tarbor. I just wanted to jump on something that Commissioner Laura Dominguez said earlier. We understand that the outdoor is the issue for the neighborhood of Sunset Harbor, but as you saw in our restaurant, we try to improve this neighborhood by a very big investment. And we have a lot of requests for our neighbors for a Sunday lunch where they want to make a birthday, bring a musician. We don't want to have to be a nightclub. This is not our goal at all, but just to create a vibe for this neighborhood, for Purdy, and to develop, because as today, Miami Beach is still a tourist city, and the tourist doesn't stay here. They just move to the other side of the bridge, and we are counting the days until we stay open, because we just got Niagara that closed also because of that. 10 years ago, Sunset Harbor was not the same as today. 10 years ago, there were nightclubs. Okay, at 5 a.m., they were making a lot of noise, but the neighborhood changed and everybody get closer, everybody exchanged to each other. We are very close to our neighborhood. We listen to them, even on our own menu of food. We're really listen to them, and we just want to have a chance for them if they want to celebrate a wedding, a birthday. We just want to have the chance to apply just for special events, maybe to start, like for New Year's Eve, Halloween, Art Basel. Those are the days that they are very important for our business to survive. Because
okay,
Miami
we need to wrap it up. Your 2 minutes is over.
Okay. Miami as a tourist city, you know that we have high season and low season. And with all those restrictions, we are in low season
okay.
all the year.
All right, you're 2 minutes up. I apologize, but we're trying to keep people to 2 minutes.
Our next caller is Michael Cantalupo.
Good morning, Michael.
Michael, you have 2 minutes. Michael, can you unmute yourself?
Michael?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I'm calling on behalf of the musicians of the city of Miami Beach and the greater Miami-Dade area. We have been fighting for a long time to be able to find places that we can play, whether this be single musicians, two musicians. The fact that the live venues are not here for us to be able to play makes us incapable of being able to stay in this city. And I really just from a standpoint of an arts and culture city that's investing in the city, you don't want your musicians to leave. It's haunting right now to walk down a lot of the entertainment streets of Miami Beach that just blast music outside with music from the early 2000s or something with no taste, no thought process whatsoever, and just busting out of a stereo. You're talking about allowing small musicians into places, into private places. And that would be enormous for the restaurants as well as the working artists in this city. I would also like to bring up the constitutionality of the protection of free speech in private places if that private place is allowing for that freedom of speech and artistic expression to be activated in there. The constitutionality of it can be discussed, and I'm willing to discuss that as well too. So realistically, if the restaurants are saying that they want it and it's not causing any sort of noise disturbance as we just spoke about beforehand, there's no issue here in a well-run city. And that's That's what I have to say.
Okay.
Our next caller is Marilyn.
Good morning, Marilyn.
Marilyn, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can hear you.
Okay. This has been going on for 2 years. And I have a few suggestions. This program, first of all, let me make a parenthesis here. We love Moloko and we love salmon, but Moloko makes noise. They have outside speakers and you can hear them all the way down almost. Some, like last Saturday night, we were coming from the theater at 11:30 and you could hear them almost from Trader Joe's. Okay, it doesn't bother me, and it doesn't bother perhaps some of the tower people because they're far away from us. But yes, they do make noise. Having said that, this music idea is good maybe for Collings Park, for the MXE district, and for Washington Avenue. But like you said, a lot of the locals, Ricky, you said that a lot of the locals don't even go to the MX district anymore. And you have to wonder why. So why do you want to bring that to the neighborhoods that want to live in peace and quiet at night, especially like Sunset Harbor and south of Fifth? There are places that should be designed or designated to have those kinds of activities. You know, we very successful, Barceloneta, the pizza place. I mean, we've been very successful here in Sunset Harbor without having to have that rackety rack. And then, of course, thank God we got rid of the Purdy Lounge. Now, having said all that, I think this plane is ready for landing. And I suggest that we bring it in and bring it to the commission, because every single month, every land use committee, we have to be coming
Marilyn,
back.
Marilyn, your 2 minutes are up.
Okay.
Our next caller is Sarah De Los Reyes.
Good morning, Sarah.
Sarah, you have 2 minutes.
Hi, this is Sarah De Los Reyes. I'm a resident of Santa Harbor and the president of Santa Harbor Neighborhood Association. We have spoken about this. We have the thing is that I have to go with what my residents voted on about a year and a half ago when we had this vote that I asked and they wanted live entertainment and they say no. I have to go with what the residents say. Another thing is that, look, we do have live entertainment in Santa Harbor because Bay Club is live entertainment and Bay Club keeps the door open. They play saxophone outside that you can hear it in the neighborhood. We don't cold code because a lot of people close their doors and they don't cold code when they have to. But we do have entertainment. We have entertainment. Barceloneta, you can hear all the music from inside Barceloneta outside. You can hear in Moloko from inside all the way outside with the speakers. They do have music. It's not like we don't have music. Then, you know, maybe they should record the music from the musician and play it. That might end up being really super nice. There will be a group, a place, they record their music and it's played by those restaurants in there. The only way to do it is the residents approve this, Ricky, and the residents don't want it. Then what can I tell you? It's not me. It is the whole neighborhood. And we're talking a lot of people. So if it was like half and half, I would say, let's try this, let's try that. But I've tried. We have tried. We ran the votes. We asked people. Most of the people do not want it. For, you know, they have a very varied experience. They love the fact the way the neighborhood is. I understand the definition of live entertainment. It's no music, no DJ, no anything. I understand that. But I'm telling you, and I understand indoors is different. I understand that. But because of the ordinance, they don't want it. The residents don't want it. And there's nothing I can do. I mean, there's nothing we can do. If the residents don't want it, what are you going to do? You got to listen to the residents.
Sarah, your 2 minutes are up.
Is there another caller?
Our next caller, we have two more. A caller named Zoom. And caller, can you please state your name first?
Hello, good morning.
Yes, hi. Hello, good morning. Matthew Galtano. Troy Wright, who is the executive director of the Washington Avenue Business Improvement District, he brought up a great point. Washington Avenue, where live entertainment is permitted, he says, is struggling right now at times. South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor, they're thriving mixed-use neighborhoods where live entertainment is not permitted. The balance today, it kind of works. It's difficult at times, but it seems to be, you know, a successful model, I guess you could say. But I want to just also bring up the fact that a few years ago, former Commissioner Aleman, she had a similar proposal, but I believe it was ambient noise, ambient entertainment instead of live is what we're looking at today. And that had tremendous community opposition. So I agree with Laura, Commissioner Dominguez, and perhaps the thriving South of Fifth and Sunset Harbor neighborhoods should not be considered today. Thank you.
Next caller.
Our last caller is James Julius.
Good morning.
James, you have 2 minutes.
Good morning. James, you're on. Hello, James.
James, can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, yes. We can hear you.
Great. So I recently moved down from New York to open some restaurants in Miami Beach. And I think what's important when it comes to the residents is to really see how the neighborhoods of Miami Beach have changed over the last 2 or 3 years since COVID. And a lot of the big restaurants have come down and really helped to, one, increase real estate prices and housing prices, and really benefited the neighborhood and brought a lot of money into the neighborhood as well. When it comes to places like South of Fifth and particularly Sunset Harbor, no restaurant is really trying to become a nightclub or, you know, have crazy parties on the weekends. They want to have live music, and that can be limited to, say, three-piece jazz bands, a DJ inside on, as you said, a few nights per week. And, you know, having worked in Miami Beach for the last few years, every restaurant is willing to play by the rules. We work in hospitality. We manage people's expectations. And it's the same with the residents. You know, test it out and give us the limitations. Give us the chance to do it. You know, and I think as a restaurant owner, we would all be willing to make the investment into soundproofing the inside. No one is asking for music outside. No one is asking for DJs or live music outside. All we want is the chance. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But without trying, and to just say, no, there's never going to be live music in South of Fifth or Sunset Harbor, Miami Beach, is very unfair. As I said, give us the chance to do it. And if it doesn't work, then we think again. But that's what I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. You want to go?
Yeah, so Nick, have we drafted up any words yet in what a potential pilot program or ordinance might look like?
We have two things. The administration has outlined, based on the committee's prior discussion, some potential terms and starting with the geographic areas where we could do this. We have also included the ambient pilot program that Commissioner Aleman sponsored, which is in the code, but the areas that the committee's been discussing are not included in that program. Tom, is there anything else you would add to that?
No, we at the direction of the Land Use Committee, the last time this was discussed in September 28th, we did prepare an outline of a potential framework for a pilot in Sunset Harbor and South of Fifth, and we also provided some additional information regarding regulations for DJs, and that's in the memo if you want to go over any of that.
Well, here's what I'd be in favor of supporting is having staff draft an ordinance that would be a pilot program that would address the types of entertainment we're talking about. As I said, I'm willing to support a pilot that's very limited, you know, Saturday, Sunday. I'm talking about indoor jazz brunch or some other type of music, no more than, as the gentleman suggested, three people, very limited hours, a very limited duration, either 6 months or a one-year pilot. And so I would like to see what a draft of that would look like, a pantomime, you know, magicians that don't make noise and things like that, but musicians up to three-piece combo or some combination of that. And then I would like to see the draft of that, and then I would like to have these neighborhood associations that are in such opposition reflect on which pieces of that they don't like, and maybe at the end of the day we say this is a pilot program that will be applicable to some neighborhoods and not others. Maybe we will exclude some neighborhoods. I don't know. I just do not understand why you can't have a jazz brunch indoors in Sunset Harbor at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It makes no sense to me. I got to drive to Wynwood to get that. Why can't I have a three-piece jazz brunch indoors in Sunset Harbor?
During the day.
During the day at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because the two speakers are the ones who are leading the opposition and misleading the neighbors, which I live in that neighborhood. They're literally doing push polls to mislead. If you read the push polls, it's basically, you know, the commission is going to open this up to rock and roll all night. Right. I think if you tailor the question, say, would you like to have a mariachi band on a Sunday between the hours of 12 and 2, the outcome would be very different. But they don't ask that question. They ask a misleading question to skew the polls. And they hand select who they give the poll to.
And we see this happen time and time again, particularly in that neighborhood.
Well, how about the fact that they're having a neighborhood commission meeting and they didn't invite you and I?
Exactly. We had to call them out on that. So I would be in favor of having that drafted and then bring it back next month. Let's look at it. Let's figure out if there's some neighborhoods we want to exclude. But I want to see what the language, specific language, would look like in a pilot, in an ordinance that would be a pilot. And then, as the lady mentioned, let's bring the plane in for a landing and let's send it back to the commission to see if there's support to do with this type of pilot program.
And my only recommendation would be, then we can look at how to control the volume rather than the type of entertainment, because I would want to try to stay away from a content-based restriction and rather focus on volume or the impacts of the performance.
We can't do content.
Right.
When I say, is there a way to do content, to say if you're doing, like I would like to say musicians, but it has to be at the same time as, say, food being served. Like I'm not looking to have a concert.
Right.
I'm looking to have brunch and be able to have some sort of music other than, you know, from, I can play it on my iPhone, I suppose, but I can't. So that's the sort of, and I'm not suggesting the genre be jazz as opposed to something else, but you'll figure out what's objective.
Sure.
And let's see what it looks like. And then
there has to be a path here where we can hopefully satisfy the most people. We're not going to satisfy everybody, but days of the week, just Saturdays and Sundays, just during the day, you have to serve food. I mean, it can't just be no. Because, I mean, we're already seeing, you know, more and more restaurants are opening across the bay. More and more of our residents are going across the bay to go for brunch or for dinner. You know, in my own neighborhood in Sunset Harbor, we're losing yet another restaurant. And the whole thing with, like, the restaurant business is you want a critical mass of restaurants to be together to make the entire ecosystem work. Why is that? When people go out to dinner, they change their minds, or they can't get reservations, or a place is full. And they like the assurity of saying, well, if one restaurant's closed, we can go to the next door one. If all of a sudden, you know, you only got one restaurant in your neighborhood, you're doomed, because that's the destination. And if that place is too full, or, you know, whatever other reason, then you're stuck. Then you got to go drive somewhere else. So you want to have a nice critical mass of businesses. And I worry again about in Sunset Harbor, rents are going up, places are closing down, so we're just going to get more yoga studios and nail salons that replace these restaurants eventually, because we're killing them off. You know, this all started many, many years ago because Iceboxed asked, they were struggling at the time, I hope they're doing better now, can we have a piano player? And, you know, these two individuals led the neighborhood to kill that request. Not even, we weren't even allowed to entertain it. And I don't think that's being a good neighbor. And that's a Miami Beach resident, somebody who lives here.
Nick, so the ordinance that you'll work on will also include options for excluding certain neighborhoods?
That's up to the committee. So if you'd like us to focus on the areas that you've discussed at prior meetings, that the administration has identified, that's entirely your call. That's a policy call.
So to that point, Commissioner, what I'd like to see is the scope of what could be permitted first, right? And then we can let these neighborhoods, it'll be published, react to that and say, well, I don't want a magician in my neighborhood, right? So maybe we'll have a different pilot program for different neighborhoods, or maybe we will completely exclude some neighborhoods from the pilot program. But I want to just see what a program could possibly look like, and I recognize we can work with you individually, and maybe there'll be a couple of different versions before it comes back.
You know what the irony is you know, south of 5th, where I lived for 20 years, they have Monty's, which is a 700-person capacity restaurant, outdoor live entertainment. And when a couple years ago, when a developer wanted to come in and redo the whole marina, the way they killed that proposal was to say, we have to save Monty's. That was one of the linchpins of that. So they were fighting to save an establishment that today would not be permitted if they were a de novo institution petitioning. That's right. The irony of this. People aren't being honest with themselves, and they're not being honest with their neighbors with what this is all about, right? We're trying to have an intelligent, responsible, professional discussion on this, and instead they're demagoguing it, which I object strongly to, because that is not being a good neighbor. We're not being good stewards of the public trust when we allow people to just inflame emotions and get people all worked up unnecessarily and unfairly, because that's not what this is about. And if you stop and think about south of 5th, they fought vehemently to protect Monty's in that last ballot proposal, which is an establishment today that would be prohibited.
Okay. So we'll show this by acclamation, continue to the April 19th meeting, and we'll come back. We'll work with the city attorney on the ordinance based upon the parameters discussed.
Yeah. The other irony is Bay Club. I think if you were to poll, in a fair poll, neighbors, do you want to close Bay Club and take away their comedy night and their karaoke night, I think most neighbors would protest vehemently against taking away their privilege to do that. That's the irony of these things. And by the way, if Bay Club were to close because they rely on those nights to stay in business, one after the other, the rest of the restaurants would start closing down because that brings people there. They go dine, and then they go to Bay Club. This is one thing that makes it unique is their karaoke night and their comedy night.
Commissioner Minor is on for items 6 and 7.
All right. Commissioner Minor, how are you today?
Good. Hello, Commissioner Arriola and everybody.
Good to hear from you.
Thanks for hearing my items.
You want me to take it in order, 6 and then 7?
Sure.
Okay. Let's go with 6. I'll tee it up and then I'll turn it over to you. Discussion sure. regarding whether to prohibit apartment hotels in additional districts or throughout the city of Miami Beach.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Tom. Thanks, Chair. And ultimately, I'm going to request to follow the recommendation of the administration to refer back to the commission to send to the planning board.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. This item has been pending for some time, and it was originally referred in October of 2021. And the primary purpose of this was to discuss whether or not there were any districts in the city remaining that allowed apartment hotel uses in those districts that prohibited all other transient uses. As you recall, in 2021, the City Commission adopted an ordinance that prohibited any future apartment hotels in the RPS 1 and RPS 2 district, which was kind of a loophole because that was the only two districts in the city that prohibited any type of transient use. We've since reviewed all of the other zoning districts, and there are no other zoning districts in the city that would permit an apartment hotel while also permitting other prohibiting other types of transient uses. The other thing we suggested as part of this item is to update and clarify the definition of apartment hotel, and we do have a draft ordinance that's attached. We've recommended that the commission send this to, or the land use committee send this back to the full commission for a referral to the planning board. The only thing that we still want to work on just a little bit is the percentage of apartment units that would be required within an apartment hotel, and we would come back with a final number if you send this to the full commission for a referral to the planning board.
Colleagues?
So I just, so what additional areas are we talking about excluding it?
None. There are no other areas that where we would need to exclude apartment hotel from. We've confirmed that apartment hotels are only permitted in those districts that currently permit hotel and suite hotel, and in some instances hostel.
So is, so I'm unclear then, are we, why would we send this to the planning board, or we would
the
not?
Reason that we, the what we're proposing be sent to the planning board is separate. It's the definition of apartment hotel, and we believe that it needs some further clarity with regard to things like the size of the required lobby, access to the actual units. The definition, which is over 30 years old, is a definition that we believe needs to be updated and further clarified so that it's less gray and more black and white.
So I'll move that item, that we move it back to the commission with the recommendation that it go to the planning board to update the definition.
Okay. And I'll show that done by acclamation.
Mr. Chairman, I see one hand up. I don't know if it's a holdover, but it's Zalman Felig.
Okay.
Zalman, are you calling about the apartment hotel item?
Actually, not. I just wanted to say something before in response, but
Zalman, yeah, we have rules and procedures. We can't allow that. Otherwise, we will never end meetings. So apologies, but we got to follow procedure. Thank you.
Number seven.
Okay, so let's go on to number seven. Commissioner Minor, you there?
Yeah, I'll just ask Tom to give a quick update, and then I'll close this item out if you agree.
Yeah, let me read it. Discussion regarding the review and approval of certificates of appropriateness.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I'll be brief on this as well. This discussion item pertained to providing a summary of the process for certificates of appropriateness, which is explained in the memo. And basically, a certificate of appropriateness is required anytime an improvement is proposed for a property within a local historic district. And the review of a certificate of appropriateness is typically done by the Historic Preservation Board. However, the code does set forth certain types of limited improvements that can be reviewed and approved by the staff to the board. And those are listed in the memo, and they include things like very limited ground level additions, replacements of windows and doors, facade restorations that are consistent with historic documentation, and minor demolition to secondary facades to address life safety needs. The other thing that we note in the memo is that pursuant to legislation adopted by the City Commission last year, we have updated the requirements for notifying affected parties of administrative level certificates of appropriateness, and that posting requirement has been fully implemented.
Colleagues? Okay. Commissioner Minor?
Oh, that's it. I think we can close that one out.
Okay. Let's close that one out. Okay. All right. Commissioner Minor, are you sticking around for anything else?
I'll stay on, but I don't have any other items, but I'll stay on.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Don't know if Commissioner Fernandez is listening. I know we have some folks here for item number five, but I want to wait for him to return. So let's take another item. I don't want to get into mine because they're going to take a while. Tom, which of these might go quickly? The rest are all Commissioner Fernandez's.
Yeah, they're all the rest of them are both yours and Commissioner Fernandez's items. So there's one that you do have, Mr. Chair, regarding improved notice requirements for property owners, which is number 13.
Okay, let's take that one.
That might be quick.
I can take this on. this is very similar to sort of residents' right to know, which is, you know, whenever there's, you know, a matter that's going to affect property owners, that they get notified. And we've you know, really principally made our notice requirements residents' right to know, which are residents. But by the same token, people who own buildings, you know, that are commercial in nature, you know, should have that same respect and notice requirement that if there's something that's going to affect the value of their property or their enjoyment of the property in any way, that they also have proper notice. Tom, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think that this, based upon the referral memo, there was a concern expressed regarding the Historic Preservation Board's process for initiating the designation process. Right now, because under our code, there is not a requirement for property owner approval of a designation, the Historic Preservation Board under the code can initiate the designation process either as part of a district or as an individual site, and they could initiate that without notifying the property owner. A member could put it on an agenda, they could discuss it, and they could direct staff to begin the designation process. At some point into the designation process, the owner would obviously be notified, but the process would have already started. And I think what you're talking about is notifying the owner before that process starts so that they can participate in that discussion before the HPB actually initiates that project.
That's one example, right? That's probably, you know, potentially, you know, the most, you know, sort of strong effect that could happen to a property owner who, you know, may be out of town, maybe out of the country because it's, you know, owned by somebody who doesn't reside here, may find out, you know, months later that something's been initiated affecting their property. But by the same token, it could be something, you know, much more benign that they would like to have input, but it's, you know, for an owner. And we want to make sure that they're getting proper notice. So do we just move this to the full commission then?
And I just want to say I want to thank you for bringing this item. I remember I placed an item on the agenda. I thought by virtue of process that it was an item that the property owners would get notification of, the affected property owners would get a notice of, including the surrounding neighborhood, and they didn't. So you're proposing something that will correct that, and I fully support you on this, and I would love to see this body send this to the full city commission.
And I think, are you talking about doing an LDR amendment that would be specific to the boards in terms of action that they can take as part of discussion items?
I mean, for sure, yes. But I think anything that would affect property owners, you know, this sort of came to me because property owners were concerned that, you know, things potentially affecting their property, they weren't getting proper notice, right or wrong, right? People always say things like that. But, you know, given the fact that commercial properties very often are owned in an LLC format, they don't reside here, they might be, you know, overseas, you know, we have to give them, you know, everything we can for proper notice to say, look, there's something going on that might affect your property. You've got 30, 60, 90 days to, you know, respond because, you know, we're going to start having hearings on this.
Perhaps it might make sense to refer this to the full commission either as a rezo directing the boards to implement a policy or perhaps as an LDR amendment that would set forth the policy, and we could work with the city attorney's office to come up with some language that would address that. I think I understand what your concerns are. It's not about curtailing the boards from discussing general policy, but when it gets specific to either an individual property or could involve individual properties, that's where some form of notice should be required.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, residents, by virtue of that term, you know, typically live here. So they know what's happening in a neighborhood. So a lot of times they, They just know what's going on. A property that's owned by, you know, a corporation where those people may not be, reside locally. If we're going to change zoning, for example, you know, make something an industrial zone, and they own a building, we want to make sure that they have ample opportunity to comment on zoning changes.
Mr. Chairman, I think I've heard enough direction from the committee. Tom, if I think we could draft an amendment, just in representing the land use boards, I've seen these discussions sort of start in the land use boards on particular properties, and I think we can address that as through an LDR amendment.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, so we'll show that by acclamation. We will bring a referral to the planning board, to the commission.
Okay, great. Okay. All right, colleagues, I'm just mindful of the time. We have an hour before the 12:30 cutoff, and let's take item 5. Don't know if this is going to take a while, but if we can sort of move it along, that would be great, because I do want to have time for my items, which I'll tell you now will likely stay here for another month or so, but I want to at least tee them up, which are items 1, 2, and 3. No, I'm sorry, 1, 1, and 2, and 4, which have to do with workforce housing.
Commissioner?
Okay, are you ready?
May I, could we do item 3? I don't think it should take that long. Okay,
okay, sure, that's an important one. Let's do 5 and then we'll do 3.
Okay.
What is that about? Somebody presenting? Somebody presenting?
Did you get to item
18? What? Item 18. No, item 18 has been deferred. Okay.
All right.
Commissioner Fernandez, item 5, which is discuss the applicability of the city's land development regulations to the co-ownership of single-family homes and whether amendments to the LDRs are necessary to address emerging business models.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this body has already discussed this in the past, and we provided direction to staff together with the city attorney's office to draft draft regulations, a code amendment, regulations for individuals and entities that manage these co-owned housing units, kind of, I guess, a process for us to have some vetting over these establishments, or not establishments, but these companies that manage these homes. And just for background, there's this new business model out there that's legal, that we cannot regulate, but an entity, a corporation, buys a house and is selling shares in the ownership of the house up to 8 owners. We don't have the ability to regulate it under state law, because it's just like if all of us sitting in this dais decided to buy a house together, nothing can prohibit us from buying property. But what we can do is establish certain regulations for the management of these properties. And what this ordinance does is establishes minimum requirements and management regulations. So, for example, if you're the management company for these homes, you need to have a physical location within close proximity of the property. Each individual unit owner needs to sign an affidavit acknowledging that they're aware of our short-term rental regulations. They need to provide a plan or a contract for yard maintenance. They need to provide a plan or some sort of provision for structural maintenance of the property and making sure that the house is painted and upkept properly. In essence, setting some basic criteria, and I don't know, Nick, if you want to expand on this, but part of it is that these companies that are engaging in this fractional ownership type of business in our residential neighborhoods would have to get a BTR from the city so that we are aware of who they are and who is coming into our city engaging in this business practice. And Nick, I don't know if you want to expand on this anymore.
Commissioner, I think you covered everything. The only thing I would add is that whether a property is owned by multiple individuals or through a corporate entity, that property is still required to comply with our short-term rental ordinance. So what that means in single-family districts is that short-term rentals are prohibited outright. And as for apartments and townhomes, a property that were owned through a co-ownership model would be required to comply with the short-term rental ordinance if they're in a district where short-term rentals are prohibited.
And we're incorporating into this a registration requirement so that, for example, I had a constituent come and see me with a complaint, a concern about a neighbor of hers. The neighbor happened to be a fractional ownership, but being that there was no full-time resident in the property, she didn't have anyone to whom to contact. So by creating a registration requirement, now there's this way that someone can contact whoever's in charge of the maintenance of the property.
That's right.
And then we're also putting in there a code of conduct, and we're also providing for code enforcement. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
I just have a question. Nick, my only question is on bullet point 7 on the co-owned may not be used for short-term or transient. I just want to make sure that having this in the policy is not going to be considered a change in our short-term rental policy for the city, which might trigger, you know, the risk the grandfather clause.
That's a good question. And what item 7 refers to is that any commercial uses that are otherwise permitted in a district would still be permitted. And I think in single family districts, I the only one that I could think of, and Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, but is for instance, a home office. I don't think there's any other commercial use, Tom, that would be
correct. And technically that's not considered a commercial use per se, because it still has to be a single family home. It just allows a homeowner under certain very limited parameters to have an office and an office address there.
Okay. And what about number 9, no outdoor? I wasn't sure why that no outdoor display of goods and merchandise shall be permitted. So what if they wanted to put a bird bath on their front lawn? Would that be a goods and merchandise?
I don't think a bird bath would be a good or
what,
I think
what
that
is,
was just
what would fall under goods and merchandise?
I think that's we viewed that as sort of belts and suspenders is to sort of control any commercialization of the property. Although again, the underlying zoning restrictions would still apply.
Okay, so I don't have any issues with this, so I'm happy to move this back to the commission. I assume that's the desire, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the only thing I'd ask is that before it gets to the commission, you look at number 9, Nick, and see if there's another way to word that or add more words so it can be more clear that, you know, we're not talking about things like bird baths and awnings and things like that. They were talking about commercial goods. And then I only have one question for, I think the Picasso people are here, and I have one question for you, and maybe you can let me know. And I probably should know the answer to this, but I don't. And whether or not these are shares, like what gets registered with the tax collector? If you sell it to 8 people, do 8 people have a separate title, or is it one title that's registered with the property collector? How is that structured?
Yeah, so the property is owned by an LLC, so the LLC hold title to the home, and then the members, so the owners of the home, are members of the LLC.
So the tax collector then sends a tax bill to the LLC?
Correct.
Okay, I understand. Thank you so much.
I would second his motion, but I can't do that. But I welcome your feedback, Mr. Chair and Commissioner.
I think we're all very sensitive to short-term rentals, and I think that's probably where this is, you know, the heart of this coming from. There are newer business models now because of technology and whatnot that enable fractional ownership. We already have timeshares here, and people do make investments in properties through an LLC. So I think so long as we're addressing the real problem we're trying to avoid, which is more short-term rentals, we're going to be in a good place.
Yeah, that's what this aims to do.
Okay. Hi, good morning.
My name is Holly Wallach. I've been a resident of Miami Beach for 40 years, and I've lived in my house for 35. And I do live near a Picasso multi-owned house. And I did move in 35 years ago to a single-family neighborhood. And unfortunately, this Picasso ownership comes from having $10 to $15 million homes that people can invest in. My question is, how are you going to regulate the short-term rental part, and how are you going to know if there's a short-term rental? I mean, I have experienced parties from 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday to 9 o'clock, and then it gets very quiet, and nobody's there the rest of the weekend. People come, people go. It's always different people. And how are you going to regulate? How are these 8 owners that own it, who's going to stop them from renting their time to someone else? And it's just, I hope that you address this problem as if one of these homes were going to move in right next to you. Thank you.
You're talking about these parties were happening at the Picasso home?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So let me speak to that, because that should not be happening. And if somebody is having a party, you should call code compliance. You should also contact Picasso, because sadly, the state law preempts us, and we cannot prevent. Wait just a minute. Let me finish. We cannot prevent this type of ownership structure in the state of Florida because it's covered by state law. And so the way we can deal with it is through code compliance. And, you know, Picasso has committed to us that they want to be good neighbors in our community. And so if they have a situation where people are not being a good neighbor, then we need to encourage them to encourage their owners to be good neighbors or else.
So I also like to be a good neighbor, and I have contacted the East Coast regional member, manager of the Picasso, that's what he told me he was, because I would rather call a neighbor before I call code compliance or the police.
Sure. Yeah.
So, and I was told that this is a completely virtual organization, that this gentleman is the manager for the East Coast.
If I may, Holly.
Sure.
Through the chair. This is going to establish a registration requirement. And it's also going to establish a requirement that the manager of the property maintain a local presence, so that removing that virtual element, now there's going to be a local presence. In addition to now being able to have a contact information for the property, which does not exist today. And in addition to that, it's requiring each individual owner, putting aside Picasso or any company, but each one of the individual fractional owners to sign a sworn affidavit agreeing and acknowledging to their understanding of our short-term rental regulations. Now, I want to ask the representative of the industry, what happens when a fractional owner disregards this and, let's say, does engage in short-term rental? What powers do you have over this? Does the person get kicked out of the fractional ownership? What happens?
Yeah, so that is a possibility. So obviously, and I'll first speak to Holly's comments about, noise or parties. You know, our owners are not precluded from any municipal ordinances that exist around noise complaints. And I know you spoke with Ramon, who's our regional manager, home manager, but he's actually based in Miami-Dade County. So if there ever is an issue and it's late night and Ramon is sleeping, I don't want to encourage you to call code enforcement on the owners, but they're not precluded from, you know, have violations enforced against them. We actually, after Holly, you spoke with Ramon did reach out to the owners that were in that property, reminding them of what the noise ordinances are. We also sent a email to all of the owners in the property, reminding them what the noise ordinances are, what they have to abide by, and the potential ramifications. Commissioner, to your question around short-term rentals, so as long as Picasso is employed by the ownership group, they actually implore us to regulate and make sure that none of the other co-owners are renting long-term or short-term of the property. If we find someone is in violation, we have the authority to suspend their stay rights, and if they don't resolve that issue, then they can be removed from the ownership group by the rest of the co-owners.
And that's significant.
Correct.
That is, that's almost more teeth than, it is, I feel, more teeth than what we have as a city and our ability to regulate short-term rental. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions?
No. Thanks. Okay. So we'll
show this as concluded, and the ordinance will be brought to the commission for first reading. Since it's a non-LDR, it doesn't have to go to the planning board. It can just be brought to the commission for first reading.
Thank you.
And Nick, you'll look at that one question I have on number 9, right?
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay, great. All right, let's do item number 3, Commissioner Franz. This is yours, Ocean Terrace Overlay LDR Amendment. What are you up to?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this item proposes to reduce the thresholds for neighborhood impact establishments in the Ocean Terrace part of the city. We want to, as part of this item, propose adding hostels as a prohibited use, as well as adding outdoor entertainment establishments and open air entertainment establishments in the list of prohibited uses. I think it's important to protect the quality of life in this area of the city, and this was a recommendation that came to us from the planning board. Mr. Planning Director, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a unanimous vote of the planning board that sent this recommendation to us, and I think it's forward thinking of them, and so I bring the item for your consideration.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, new Commissioner Dominguez, welcome. Neeson Kazan, representing Ocean Terrace Associates, Ocean Terrace Holdings, which, as you know, owns the 7400 block from 74th to 75th and Ocean Terrace. There are a few things that need to be addressed with regard to this, and I understand that Commissioner Fernandez is responsive to a planning board resolution, but let me first talk about the original sin. That item was brought before the planning board at the meeting without notice to any affected property owner. That's when it was the original resolution was passed. So we believe it was tainted from the beginning because there was no input or notice to any of the stakeholders or interested parties there. But let me go beyond that to the substance. This really is, Ocean Terrace is not Ocean Drive. It is a two-block cul-de-sac, an area that is in need of revitalization. There has been no statement of a case or facts to show where it's needed. There is no problem on Ocean Terrace with regard to outdoor entertainment establishments and neighborhood entertainment establishments. The city administration, the staff, has looked at this and has made a recommendation to not proceed with the limitations on neighborhood impact establishments and outdoor entertainment, but only hostels, which we don't have an objection to. In a way, we think this is an ordinance in search of a problem. Now, if you talk about noise and events, the biggest generator of noise is the North Shore Bandshell, which is literally across the street from the properties on Ocean Terrace. And that is what creates the noise and activity in that area. So, if I may have another couple of minutes, Mr. Chair. So, singling out Ocean Terrace for this treatment, this unique treatment, just doesn't really make sense. We believe that it is harmful to small businesses that already exist on the street. It will discourage investment in Ocean Terrace. You also have to understand, when the Ocean Terrace overlay was done, there actually were restrictions that restricted some of the things that could be done otherwise in other MXE districts. So it's already more restrictive. Finally, I would point out that Ocean Terrace Holdings, which has an enormous investment in that neighborhood, has a development agreement with the city in connection with their redevelopment of all of Ocean Terrace, the park, and the vertical park there. And that development agreement protects Ocean Terrace from application of new zoning adopted since the development agreement. So it really wouldn't technically, even legally, apply to Ocean Terrace Holdings properties. The other major interest there is Saint-Tropez, the residential condominium, which has been completely in support of the Ocean Terrace overlay and has voiced no objections or support for this particular ordinance. So not quite sure where this germinated from at the planning board, but we believe it was never done with a proper input or notice. There is really no good reason for it, and we'd ask you not to have this move forward, except if you want to add the hostile prohibition, we're fine with that.
You want to go? Yeah. Yeah, Neeson, thanks so much. Help me to understand, was this something that just came out of the planning board, or was it sent to the planning board?
No, something that just came out of the planning board.
Okay.
Why?
Yeah, why? Do we know?
So a planning board member, the origin of this was a planning board member made, and Tom can verify this, made a motion at a planning board meeting that they should move forward with an ordinance with these limitations. That motion was not on the agenda, was not on the published agenda, was not advertised. It was just someone from the planning board saying, I think we ought to do this. It starts from a place that it never should have started from.
Nick, how is that even in order in a parliamentary proceeding?
The planning board and all of our land use boards occasionally schedule discussion items, you know, sort of informally. I think part of what Commissioner Ariola's other item is intended to address is when a discussion item relates to a specific property. But this particular discussion item, I mean, the planning board couldn't take any formal action on that date. All they could do was to transmit a recommendation.
Nick, I don't think it was even listed as a discussion item, if I'm not mistaken.
We can look into that. I mean,
So if that's the case, because I mean, when I saw this, I'm like, where is this coming from? Other than, you know, my colleague Commissioner Fernandez, I don't remember ever discussing this as a body. And so, you know, when you have our land use boards, you know, running renegade, coming up with their own stuff that we're not directing them, or that, you know, really weren't germane to, you know, a discussion item, that's not their purview. They should not be doing that.
Well, the land use, if I may, Mr. Chair, I mean, the land use boards, the planning board does have the ability to initiate, I believe, legislation, but
that's right.
It has to be done with notice, published notice, so that affected parties are aware that it's going to be discussed. You can't just bring it up spontaneously at a meeting and then start passing resolutions. That's what the problem was.
Yeah.
And I think, I think Commissioner Fernandez is just being responsive to what came from one of the boards, but this is the history of how it came from that board.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yep.
So when I look at the agenda for the April 26, 2022 planning board meeting, I see an item under discussion items, item number 13, discussion on the Ocean Terrace MXC district. The discussion item was placed on the agenda, was advertised on the agenda. Moreover, to that, we have a section of the code. We're all familiar with it, section 2-14. It's the residents' right to know section of the code. And on every agenda item, we have to identify, is this item a residents' right to know item? This specific discussion item was marked as yes, that it was a residents' right to know item. And what does that mean is that there's an email that goes out from the city and notifying people that this is an item that might be of interest to them. So this discussion item, it was advertised on the agenda of that planning board meeting. And moreover, not only was it placed on the agenda, but it was notified of a resident's right to know, enhancing the public knowledge of this item. So I respect Mayor Kasten a lot, but it was properly placed on that agenda, and they were planning to have this discussion about this district at that meeting. Thank you.
I believe, Commissioner, it may have been discussed before then, but I need a check to verify that.
Okay. Well,
but I think, as you said, you've got a development agreement with the city, so It wouldn't affect this, but it could affect the properties, I guess, at Saint-Tropez, right?
There are a couple of businesses there that could be affected.
I am supportive of the recommendation from the administration to add the hostel, because I think we would not want, I don't think there would ever be one there, but I don't think we want a youth hostel in that commercial space under that condominium. And I think the way I'm reading your memo, Tom, that is your only recommendation, right?
Yeah, we had also recommended that if there is a proposal to modify outdoor entertainment, that it not be prohibited outright, but that instead some more controlling parameters potentially be looked at, which could include something along the lines of limiting outdoor and open-air entertainment to restaurants, limiting the hours, and making it ambient only. We did not make any modifications to the draft ordinance that reflects the recommendation of the planning board. Those were just some of the observations that we made in the memo.
Yeah. And have you drafted an overlay yet that would be just inclusive of hostels?
No. This was a dual referral to both the Land Use Committee and to the Planning Board. We have not yet taken it to the Planning Board because we wanted to see what the recommendation of this board is. But the ordinance that's before you does include all of the recommendations of the Planning Board, which would include the limitations on NIE thresholds as well as a prohibition on outdoor and open-air entertainment.
So I'm not prepared to support the entertainment piece at this point because there's a development agreement. That's not going to be affected. And the only other outdoor space that I know of is under Saint-Tropez, and there's a big courtyard area. And I would rather wait to see if in the future there's going to be some problem. I think that's most, for the most part, that space I think is vacant or underutilized. So, colleagues, I would be supportive of limiting hostels. I don't think that would ever happen there, but I certainly would never want that because that would not be the best use of that land. So I'll move that we direct them to the staff to prepare an ordinance prohibiting hostels on Ocean Terrace if that's something that the body wants to support, and we could move that back to the commission.
Yeah, so I agree with you. For all the reasons you mentioned when I read this, I said, well, for sure, hostels. But everything else, I said, I think it's premature. Let's wait and allow the overall project to come on board before we start restricting things that haven't even happened yet. I didn't know the history of how this came before us, but, you know, if people aren't clamoring for this and this just came at the will of the planning board, I'm not ready to support that today, but I am prepared
to. Public comment or only?
Yeah. I'm talking. Okay? I see you there.
You took a motion.
Okay, but that's the way we do it. Okay, all right. Daniel, you know I'm fair to you. I'm talking. Anyway, so I support your motion. Daniel.
No, Daniel Serrato with MDPL. It is disappointing because the planning board members do have the right to have ideas. And to see some of the members here kind of dismiss it as, you know, oh my God, an original idea came from a city board of people that we appointed as experts is really not, I think, the intent of the planning board and the city code. So I don't know what's going on, but Alex, you used to be on the planning board. They have the right to have ideas. You guys aren't experts on planning. Sorry. You have a board.
Well, I object. I've been doing this for 8 years, and I got a master's degree in urban planning. I'm more qualified than almost anyone there. So
well, that's
I hope
fine,
you didn't mean me.
But don't you agree they should have ideas? Or do you want an ordinance, no new ideas, unless they come from the people, you know, in the back of the room? I don't think that's a good way to run a city.
Okay. Thanks. Daniel. You're charming as always.
Go ahead.
Question. It said that the city didn't approve or didn't recommend that outdoor entertainment be prohibited in its entirety. What portion would you recommend?
What we had suggested, Commissioner, in the memo is that Another option would be to further regulate outdoor and open air entertainment. And what we had suggested in the memo was a couple of things. One, that open air and outdoor entertainment would only be permitted as part of a restaurant establishment which serves food at all time and would not be permitted as part of a standalone bar or lounge. That the hours of outdoor and open air entertainment be limited to no later than midnight on Fridays and Saturdays and no later than 10 p.m. Sunday through Thursday. And that within areas of an establishment containing outdoor and open air entertainment, any sound related to recorded music, TV sets, or performances, including DJs, not exceed ambient background levels at any time.
And I have a question for Alex. Has the Saint-Tropez been approached on this?
I have not heard from Saint-Tropez. I would say that I think it's also important to consider the fact that the boundary of this does extend up to Collins Avenue to the west, on the western boundary of this. And I think it's important to consider that because, you know, if we're thinking only about Ocean Terrace, well, yeah, that tends to be a quaint, more calm and quiet street. But we should consider, though, that when we're talking about Collins Avenue, it is a different, perhaps it could attract a different type of use that we may not want to attract there, that perhaps even staff's recommendation here may be helpful in preserving the character of that area, especially when we're in such close proximity to an important asset to our city that we've invested and continue to invest in, which is the Miami Beach Bandshell. And so we want to maintain that cultural feel there. And so I wouldn't want to see, outdoor entertainment that's not associated to a restaurant. I don't think it would be conducive having that so close to a venue, a cultural venue like the Bandshell, especially when we're fronting Collins Avenue.
Mr. Chair, may I? Collins Avenue, all the two block strip there is CD2. There are also a lot of ongoing businesses on the 7300 block. I don't think they're aware at all whatsoever that there would be something that would be imposed on their on what they can or cannot do. I think, you know, we need to get all the stakeholders really engaged before we move forward with any legislation such as that, in my opinion.
So just so I can understand the geography, we're talking about basically from the ocean, between 73rd and 75th. From the ocean to the west side of Collins?
East side of Collins.
To the east side, not the west side, right. Of east side. And I don't know that there are any venues, but I agree with you, Mr. Kazin, that they probably don't even know that this conversation is going on. So the question is, because I'm reading your memo, and on page 13, you talk about the hostel, and then it's the next page where you say, if there is a desire to have more control over outdoor, and then you're talking about, I guess, establishments with indoor entertainment to an occupancy content in excess of 125, right?
Yeah, currently it's 200. If you have, under the code now, if your indoor establishment proposes entertainment and the OCC load is over 200, you have to go to CUP. What we were suggesting is that if there was a desire to impose some controls, that the NIE threshold limit only apply to those establishments that had indoor entertainment.
Yeah. So I think there may be a place to add some or all of what you're suggesting if we want to do that. So the question is, do we want to move the hostel back to the commission?
Bifurcate that.
And bifurcate this or keep everything here for another month and look at it. I think there needs to be community outreach. I guarantee you those businesses don't know. A lot of the stuff on the noise makes sense to me, and I don't think it would, because outdoor entertainment would still be allowed. It's just we're limiting to some hours and so forth. And those condos probably don't want outdoor entertainment past midnight, I would not think.
This item, just for clarification, was a dual referral, so it doesn't need to go back to the commission. Whatever you recommend is what we would take to the planning board.
Mr. Chairman?
What if we do this? What if we send it to the planning board saying we want to eliminate the opportunity for hostels, and we want the planning board to consider the recommendation of the administration and then come back with a recommendation? Would that come back to us or back to the commission?
It would normally go back to the full commission. The planning board would transmit the ordinance with a recommendation to the full commission.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Sure.
Is there a public notice that's sent out when it goes to the planning board?
Yes, because this particular ordinance involves changes in use and the area is less than 10 contiguous acres, there would be a 30-day mail notice to all property owners.
So the property owners will be notified. And when it goes to City Commission, are they notified when it goes to City Commission?
The same notifications require for both readings before the City Commission.
And is there a public hearing at the City Commission?
Both hearings are a public hearing.
And is this item advertised as a residence right to know item?
Yes.
Does that provide an enhanced notice than what normally every item receives?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask Mr. Kasdan, can I ask you another question, please? So if changes were made on this outdoor entertainment, your client has a development agreement already, those would not be applicable to your client? So it would basically only be applicable to the area outside the development agreement? Or do you think that if we were to limit outdoor entertainment to midnight, because I guess your development agreement says no zoning changes, is that right?
That you have to abide by the code that all parties, city and the developer, by the code that was in effect at the time the development agreement was adopted. There are some exceptions for like public matters of public health and safety, which can give the city the right to legislate, but they're very narrowly prescribed. I also believe there's one of the business owners on the street is trying to speak, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chairman, we have one caller. We also have Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez has her hand up.
Let's take Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez first then.
Okay.
Good morning, Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez.
Hi. Yes. I just wanted to say that I know that I'm assuming it's only until midnight, but I wouldn't want to hurt. The only person that has live music on Ocean Terrace right now is Ronnie's, and they have a really nice crowd, and it would really do a lot of damage to that business. So if we could especially make a point to reach out to Ronnie and let him know what's happening, just in case, just because I think that he would be very upset. So that's all I wanted to say.
No. Good morning, Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez. You and I are aligned on that issue, so thanks for calling that in. And again, she raises a really good point, right? So it's an amenity that residents enjoy, particularly residents there more than tourists. It's a local business owner, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, per the earlier discussion we had, you know, trying to outlaw this pretty much everywhere, make it impossible. Like, this can coexist peacefully with residents if it's well done, okay? And these blanket prohibitions end up killing businesses, but then they end up killing us as residents because we end up living in a city that, you know, is a sleepy town, and if we ever want to go enjoy a meal or any entertainment, we got to cross the bay. And so, again, these blanket ordinances that just prohibit things, I think, do a disservice to us as residents. So, Commissioner Fernandez, to take Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez's point, how would that fit in? I mean, is Ronnie's in the overlay?
Yes.
It's in the overlay, so it wouldn't affect them?
Where is Ronnie's located?
It's in the San Tropez, I believe.
Because anybody that has an existing duly licensed use would not be affected by this legislation.
They're grandfathered in, but yeah. the issue then is, you know, if they vacate, right?
Yep. Well, their successor in interest would still be able to
But they only have like 6 months per our right?
Correct. A new tenant would have to assume the use within 6 months.
Right. So what happens is we did that years ago. We made it so restrictive so that, you know, yes, you get grandfathered in, but it's so tight. They got to jump through so many hurdles that a lot of times these privileges lapse. And we did that deliberately to try to sunset people from having those 5 a.m. licenses. But what happens where it's live entertainment, it's compatible with the neighborhood, neighbors are used to it. And then once it's gone forever. So that's my hesitancy of being overly aggressive with this. I mean, you know, we would talk about the ban shell. We all enjoy the ban shell. But if you had to, like, de novo start with something where, you know, hey, we're going to plop in an outdoor entertainment venue in the middle of a residential neighborhood, residents would go nuts. By the same token, if you try to take away the ban shell, they'd go nuts.
But can I just explain a concern that I have? I think I see this just seeing the experience that we've had, like, for example, on Ocean Drive. Sometimes on Ocean Drive, when you have outdoor entertainment and that type of stuff, you just see all of a sudden you're walking, and then you see the gathering of people at that location. And I think that that's where we kind of have to differentiate between Ocean Terrace and Collins Avenue. Let's say you want to allow this on Ocean Terrace. Well, Ocean Terrace is not a main thoroughfare. You don't have a lot of traffic there. It doesn't create a public safety issue for police or crowd management issue. When we're talking about Collins Avenue, we don't want to create an issue where now you have crowds gathering, sidewalks being blocked, or an issue where you have overflow into the street. That's my only thinking here, or any other type of, you know, loud activity that could compete with the band shell, which ultimately to me sets the theme for entertainment in the area there, sets the vibe for the entertainment there. That's my, you know, only thinking on that.
Mr. Chair, if I may just make one more point. Thank you for the generosity of time. The existing businesses, like the Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez mentioned, even if they are grandfathered in, if the rule changes so that that same business cannot be continued, it affects, among other things, the saleability of that business. It sort of makes it unsellable. So all the investment and time that someone has put into building a business, there's no exit for them.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. There's another caller.
We do still have one caller, James Riccio. And I see Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez's hand. I'm not sure if she wants to speak again, but she has her hand up.
Let's give her that opportunity. Commissioner Rosen Gonzalez, do you have your hand up or do you want to speak?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay, next caller.
James Riccio.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you have 2 minutes.
Great. Thank you very much for taking me. No, I am in the process of opening Sushi Beachy on 74th and Ocean Terrace on the corner in the Saint-Tropez condominium. I've been working on this project for about 3 years now. The space is mostly outdoors. It's going to be a high-end restaurant, let's say with a $70 per person average. And my intention is to only do things here in a very tasteful manner. I don't foresee myself having any type of entertainment here. But perhaps in the future, I might want to have a DJ or a band. It's not my intention at this time or that type of business. But the time, energy, monies that I spent on this area, you know, I didn't have any thought that there was any restriction when I rented the space a long time ago. I haven't been, nobody has reached out to me or to Ronnie's previously. I know Ronnie has some live entertainment that is followed by a lot of locals. They enjoy it. We're both pretty much right next to a band shell. He's right across the street. I'm about a short half block away. The music from the band shell when they have bands is audible from like two blocks away. Uh, it would be it would be odd if Ronnie or any venue on the St. Tropez or on the 7500 block could not have live music in a tasteful manner, and then the band shell, which is right next to us, can have music that can be heard from two blocks away. There's something there that just does not seem ideal or fair.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and you may not know this. We talked about it earlier today, but you know our city's definition of live entertainment is extremely broad. So while you may not contemplate live entertainment at the moment, you may not even know that you know, some fairly innocuous type entertainment would be prohibited. So even though you know you may not contemplate it now, anything other than just ambient noise played over a stereo system would likely trigger a violation of our live entertainment ordinances if we were to not allow it for whatever reason in this overlay. All right, colleagues, there was a motion. It was seconded.
So I'm willing to move immediately the item back to the commission on the hostels, but I think it needs more work on the entertainment so that we can either bifurcate it and move that hostel back and work on this, or we can hold the whole thing and to the planning, that's right, as opposed to
My appetite is just the hostel.
Yeah. That was my earlier motion to send that. And then if you'll want to continue to work on this, the noise and thing, and then bifurcate it and have it as a separate item. There may be something to do, but I think we should just go ahead and send that to planning.
Okay. Fair enough.
So the motion, just so I have it clarified, the motion was by Commissioner Richardson, seconded by Commissioner Areola, and the recommendation to the planning board would be to only prohibit hostels as the amendment, and no other changes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. And if another member wants to bring a separate item to address the entertainment, that can be done, and we can work on it.
So what would happen for that to happen?
Just do a resolution. You could just do a resolution, or I don't know, Tom, can we keep
this
here?
Item.
If we bifurcate, can we keep the item here?
It would be, I think, up to the sponsor if he's willing to bifurcate it have the remainder of the proposed ordinance remain here.
Yeah,
procedurally, Mr. Attorney, can I do that procedurally?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so to clarify, what we'll do is we'll bring the ordinance to the planning board with just the prohibition on hostel, and then we'll continue this to the April meeting, and we'll bring back the remainder of the ordinance as it pertains to outdoor entertainment and the NIE thresholds.
Yeah, and if there's a way to do some additional community outreach, I think we ought to hear from everybody that owns property and lives in the area and see what they think, because there may be something that we can tailor, but at this point, I'm not ready to support that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, just my appetite for further curtailing live entertainment outdoor is minuscule. Just FYI. Commissioner Rose Gonzalez, is she still on?
She is still on, yes.
Okay. Commissioner Rose Gonzalez, we have a hard stop at 12:30, but if by any chance you can hang out till then, I wanted to discuss a few things that I'm working on. Are you okay? Can you hang out?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Yeah, I'd love to get your opinion on what I'm about to tee up, which a lot of this has to do with workforce housing. I think it's something that you also share a strong desire to see us address. So these are items, and I'll tee them up, items 1, 2, and 4. They're all sort of interrelated. And sort of the policy issue is, you know, how do we build and attract more workforce housing into Miami Beach? You know, we've got a lot of obstacles to make this happen, not the least of which is just the cost of land here, also just the cost of construction, and then, you know, our fairly restrictive development rights and zoning ordinances, which, you know, limit things like FAR and density, height, et cetera. So, you know, how do we tackle that? Among the things that, you know, I'm bringing forward and we're keeping here in land use is the discussion around, you know, zoning changes that other jurisdictions throughout the county have done. The first one is item number one, which is a discussion to create transfer of development rights, which would include receiving and transfer districts, something Miami Beach doesn't currently have. Other jurisdictions, you know, throughout our country have done this. Even City of Miami across the bay has done this, which is basically create the ability of properties to transfer development rights to other properties elsewhere in the city, which would be the donation of development rights to a recipient property in exchange for funds. The transfer doesn't increase overall FAR in the city, but it just reallocates it to from one property to the other. The idea being it might allow the recipient property to create more workforce housing. The donor property would then take those funds that they receive and invest it in things like resiliency or historic preservation. So that's item number one. Tom, do you want to expand on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, basically the theory behind or the concept behind transfer of development rights is that you're not increasing the overall intensity within the city, but you're simply allowing or creating a vehicle for allowable intensity to be relocated. So, for instance, if you've got historic districts that are identified as having excess development capacity, but it becomes very difficult to maximize that development capacity without doing substantial surgery to the historic building or even demolishing portions of it, those tend to be ideal sending districts where a property owner could send their available development rights, then be required to utilize at least a portion of those proceeds to fully restore the building. And then the receiving sites are typically areas of the city that are ripe for new construction and additional development rights. They're typically located on transit corridors and in areas that don't require a significant increase in parking and can be accessed by other forms of transit so as not to have a negative impact on overall congestion.
Yeah, I thought you outlined it well in your memo, which is, you know, if you look at our historic districts, Flamingo Park, Ocean Beach Historic District, Museum Historic District, Collins Waterfront, Normandy Isle, North Shore Historic District, Flamingo, those would be the donor districts to the extent that they have unused FAR that they probably couldn't utilize because they're historic properties. They could transfer those development rights to areas that we've designated as recipient areas, like you said, corridors that are aligned with, you know, mass transit or, you know, just overall transit commercial areas. The financial transaction, the economics, the money would go back into the historic district to maintain the properties, make them more resilient, beautify them and or, you know, the surrounding areas. We would then have, at least for me to sponsor this, I would want to have the requirement that the recipient of that FAR would use it for workforce housing. So that's basically the concept. Neeson, you want to jump in first?
Yeah, I'd just like to briefly address it, and I have no dog in this fight, but I think that you have put your finger on what is the most significant. If we're serious about increasing workforce housing in the city, this is what's going to produce it. Everything else is just playing around the edges, and which means that you're going to have to incentivize it to create the
need greater density so that the cost is justified. You know, also the TDR program has been used successfully in Miami's historic districts. And if you're targeting that to workforce housing, I mean, you've come up with a series of things that are really standard tools in many other cities that prove to be the greatest way to produce the most amount of workforce housing. So I just wanted to say that this has worked. It's worked in other cities. If we're serious about really increasing workforce housing, and I mean long-term commitments to the workforce housing, not, you know, multi-year commitments, then this is the way we have to go. Nothing else is going to produce meaningful numbers.
I mean, I'm serious about workforce housing. That's why I'm proposing these things. I've got, whatever, eight months left or whatever. This is really the only thing I'm going to really focus as a priority on, which is workforce housing. And it's going to be time for us as a body and eventually voters to put up or shut up. Because I've been here 7.5 years, and we've built barely any workforce housing. I was quoted in the Miami Herald saying it's an embarrassment. I think we, you know, before any of us were commissioners, back dating to 2013, that commission and mayor had promised voters that we would have 16,000 workforce unit housing by the year 2030, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, 2030? Mm-hmm. 16,000. Which, you know, on its face, the day that that was passed was absurd because, you know, it would have dramatically increased the housing stock in this city if anyone bothered to, you know, put that numerator over the denominator. You know, that was never going to happen. Then we whittled it down to, I think, 6,000. That's still a pipe dream. I think we barely built 200. And the reason is what I outlined is it's very expensive to buy land here. We have very restrictive zoning and development laws on our books. So if we're going to build workforce housing, we need to create the tools and mechanisms to do that. All of what I'm talking about here is going to ultimately have to go to voters. So if we pass something to put before the ballot to voters, they're going to have the ultimate say. And if they vote it down, fine. Then we just end the discussion of workforce housing in Miami Beach as a policy matter, and we pull it out of the comp plan, and we will be a city that is for the rich, okay, because that's the only housing stock we'll eventually have left here. Or we're going to do something that creates housing for everybody, and we have a true mixed use city at all economic levels. So we got to come up with the mechanisms for doing that. As Neeson mentioned, this is one of the tools that other cities have been using. So, Commissioner Rosa Gonzalez, I don't know if you're out there. I don't want to throw you into the water first, but colleagues, I mean, is there appetite for this kind of thing? Because I do want to workshop this here for the next couple of committee meetings, and then to the extent that we come up with any resolution, pass it to the full commission for further vetting.
I have a couple of questions. So when you transfer, would we designate certain areas that could be donor and recipient communities and vice versa? So, or would it be citywide or?
No, there would be very specific sending districts that would be identified and very specific receiving districts. The reason that voter approval is required is because the receiving districts would be exceeding their currently zoned FAR. And there would also be a cap placed upon the amount of FAR that could be received in receiving districts.
Yeah. So I would be very interested. I'm very supportive because we need to get busy with workforce housing. And I would be interested in seeing specific language and recommendations on which districts would be sending and receiving and kind of looking at the next level. You know, it's no secret that, you know, I've been working in the north with a Byron Carlisle with workforce housing. Servitas has not wanted to move forward until the Collins Park is closed out. Things have changed also in that the cultural bond now is providing a lot more money, so we may not need as many units there to pay for the entire building. But I'm still very interested in having a mixed-use facility there if that's what the community will support, to have workforce housing, because I think we can accomplish two things at one, and that is to have a cultural space and workforce housing. You know, arguably we have a lot of workforce housing here. It's just not designated as workforce housing. If you look in Flamingo Park, I call it some of these old buildings that are run down. So what we're talking about is the difference between an improved property that would be the same price as somebody's paying for an older property that's less desirable perhaps for them to live in. And so the only way we're going to move the needle forward is to adopt something like this. So I'm very supportive.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Rosa-Gonzalez has her hand up.
Okay, great. Do you want to go first? Okay. Commissioner Rosa-Gonzalez?
Hi, Commissioner Arreola. So, Tom, you said that first and foremost, I understand where this is coming from, and I know that we have a comp plan, and we have the 6,000 to 8,000 units that we're not even close to building. Tom said that this would be referendum protected, correct?
That's correct.
The thing is, I would have to just look at the receiving district. I mean, I don't want to say no flat out without even knowing what it's about. I would just remind you that right now people can't get around the city. You know, the traffic is so bad. And I think that, you know, they would have, I just don't know. I would have to take a look and see. That's all I can say. But it's an interesting discussion to have. So I will study it. And if you're going to workshop it in the future, I'll take a look at it and try to be open-minded.
Okay. That's all we can ask is to be open-minded and to study. I mean, I think, you know, that the different issue of the Metro Mover now that we're all getting hammered on, you know, the issue is, yes, there's traffic. There's definitely no denying that. The question is, where's it coming from? Why is it here? Right. It's not all tourists. It's people going to work, you know, people doing their daily chores, et cetera. To the extent that we can do a better job planning so that we might mitigate some of the need for people to jump in a car and move, that would help. To the extent that we can provide mass transit, that's going to help. You know, otherwise, we're just doing a lot of talking as a body, and I'm not sure why we get elected if all we're going to do is talk and not actually try to make some decisions that are going to make us unpopular with some people. But that are actually trying to do what we were elected to do, which is solve the day-to-day problems that people have, which is housing affordability and traffic and quality of life. Those decisions will upset some people that don't want the Metro Mover for whatever reason, people who complain about traffic but don't offer solutions, people that, you know, want housing to be more affordable but don't want housing built in their backyard. You know, this is why we get elected, to make those kinds of decisions.
Do you want to say anything?
Sure. Yeah, I'm open to this concept as well, keeping in mind that the historic districts wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of height. Flamingo Park sent something in today, so that's something that I would be mindful of, but absolutely open to seeing more and learning more about the concept.
Yeah, the historic districts would be the donor sites. This has to make sense from a planning perspective. And I think, by the way, just it's a short memo, and Tom did a really good job, or more likely Rogelio did a good job of outlining this. I think the corridors that you list here make a lot of sense. There might be others, but those are some of the obvious ones. Joseph?
Yeah, Joseph Magazine, 650 West Avenue. Quickly, I'd like to echo the comments of a caller earlier, just thanking everybody for their dedication towards making our city better. I think Commissioner Richardson really hit the nail on the head with some of his last comments. I'd like to just take that a step further. I applaud the focus on full-time residential housing. I think full-time residents are what strengthens the fabric of our community. And the more full-time residents we have, the more resident-centric community-wide amenities we all get to enjoy. Tying this in with actually the other ordinance about increased FAR for workforce housing, I'm supportive of the concept, and just speaking on my own personal behalf. As we look around our region, residential housing is being added at a once-in-a-generation pace, but Miami Beach is largely on the sidelines. However, I don't believe, although it may be one component, workforce and affordable housing is our most pressing need where we put all of our eggs in one basket. I think if we looked at the true data, market rate three-bedroom housing in non-prime infill areas is by far our most pressing need. With so much effort to diversify our economy, which I very much support, I'm afraid the efforts will be futile with our current stock of lack of current stock housing that's suitable for families. Just a little data. Right now on MLS, south of 50th Street, there are a grand total of 8 three-bedroom units for sale under $1.5 million. In that same area, only 2 three-bedroom units available for rent under $6,500. In that same area, there are 475 studio 1 and 2 bedrooms for sale under $800,000. So to Commissioner Richardson's point, some of that is organically occurring workforce and affordable housing. 1 studio and 1 bedrooms for sale under $450,000. I'm sorry, there's 285 studio and 1 bedrooms for sale under $450,000 and 100 units for rent under $2,100 per month. So truly our most pressing need is 3-bedroom units accommodated for families. I'm a young working professional. If I wanted to have another child and move into a 3-bedroom house, I make a very nice living. I wouldn't qualify for a workforce at affordable housing. But I also wouldn't be able to price myself into that category of buying a $2 million 3-bedroom unit. So if we're going to facilitate some of our most pressing urban planning needs, I ask that we would also consider maybe market rate 3-bedroom units that we help facilitate, because that truly is our most pressing need when we look at the data. So I'm very supportive of some of the concepts we're talking about. I just ask that we do a little more analysis and expand that data. So thank you very much.
Definitely a fair point. Thank you. All right, we're running. We have 2 minutes, 1 minute left. Colleagues, we're not going to take up another item because...
No, but I just have one other question to Joseph's point. Can we look at what Miami and some other communities are doing and see if they're doing any larger units, or is everything... Because, you know, everything is smaller units, right? So...
There are areas of other cities that are doing larger units. Miami Beach does a lot of larger units. For instance, the 2 projects that were recently completed on the ocean, they actually tore down buildings with smaller units, and they're now big luxury units. And so,
yeah, but the point of the difference is that those are at commercial rate, and if we're talking about workforce housing with some restrictions on, you know, with income and with...
We could take a look at what they recently got approved in the North Beach area, the Miami Beach Housing Authority. I believe those are a mix of 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom units. Some are a little bit bigger, some are smaller, but we could come back to you with some data on what they permitted. Those are workforce and affordable.
I like to look at that because from a development perspective, there's probably a reason they're doing 1 and 2 bedrooms if they're at the commercial rates. But if we give them incentives for density, then we have to get something in exchange, and that is some limitation off of AMI or something, right, so that it's truly workforce housing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that may incentivize the developer to do 3-bedroom as opposed to a lot of 1 and 2s, which they can make more money off of that combination.
Let me help you with that. That would be my item number 4, which is separate from the TDR discussion. Again, this would have to be something that voters would approve, which is to create these kinds of incentives, discuss increasing allowable FAR for workforce housing, right? So if you want to try to, you know, get developments done that are larger in nature, you're going to need more FAR.
Maybe when we ask staff to look at that, we should get recommendations on your other one. Was what? Which one was the?
Well, I was talking about item number 1, which is TDRs. So the TDR is one is to try to create some tools for workforce housing, but it's really a historic preservation item as well, which is, you know, you're leaving the historic districts intact. Some of the properties there, as we know, are challenged for resiliency. They're old. They economically, because of rents and the amenities that they lack, like parking, washer and dryers, you know, lack of pools and gyms and doormen, you know, they're always going to be sort of, like you said, workforce housing. But they don't have the economics to charge super premium rents so that property owner can reinvest in the building. So the buildings start becoming dilapidated. If we could create an economic mechanism for them to say, okay, we've got, you know, 1,000 extra feet of FAR that we'll donate, we'll take in whatever, however you price that, several hundred thousand dollars in exchange, and then we'll reinvest in storm windows, you know, other resiliency efforts. You know, you get double the good. You protect the building, and then you're providing workforce housing FAR somewhere else in the city. Item four is actually going to voters and saying, if we were to designate for workforce housing, would you allow an increase in FAR for developments? That'll be a question for voters. But that's how we'll get what you're talking about, Commissioner Richardson, which is economic incentives to do workforce housing. Because right now, the economic incentive is to do luxury. Because if you look at, I'm thinking the Ocean 57 project, mm-hmm. right, which is a beautiful building. What those units were selling for on a per square foot basis before that building and versus what they're selling for now, it is 4X, 5 times X, maybe more. I mean, I think it's, I'm going to guess it's $2,000-$3,000 a square foot now.
And some
before
of those
that
buildings,
was $500 a square foot.
Developers have literally bought out every condominium unit owner, which was unheard of 5 years ago.
By the way, that's going to happen more and more with this new legislation that, in my opinion, that Tallahassee's passed, which is requiring condominium boards to certify now under 20 years and to have full reserves. So the special assessments that are being imposed on especially older buildings is more than most people can afford, and you'll start seeing people sell out to developers. Developers will knock down those buildings and in their place do more luxury high-rises. I believe that. So anyway, we'll keep this up here. But colleagues, give this some real thought, because if this is going to go to voters, you know, we're going to be up against the calendar. So we'll have to move something to the full commission, you know, by early summer, I think. So that means we probably have, you know, two, maybe three more meetings to hammer this out.
What would be the deadline, July?
Working backwards, because we'll have to have two hearings at the full commission, right? We have August break, and it has to be the county before that. So help me out, Nick.
So I think with what we've done with prior LDR amendments that include an FAR increase is we hold first reading at the same time as the ballot question. So if our goal is first reading and a ballot question in July, which is the county's deadline, then I would think you'd want to be at the planning board comfortably if you know, if they want to hold two hearings, but maybe by May.
By May. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my goal. I mean, we have another meeting in March mm-hmm. here and then another one in April. So
right.
at least two more meetings here before we go to full commission,
right.
which would be depending April or May.
And refer it to the planning board. Right.
Yeah, so definitely give this some thought. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you.